Good afternoon, and I'd like to welcome all to the November meeting of the Commonwealth Transportation Board. While folks are taking their seats, I would like to talk a little bit about logistics. We have a long, as usual, a long work session agenda. The final item, number 9 on your agenda, by design, carry over the work session until tomorrow morning. So that we can hear the presentation on Journey Through Hallowed Ground. After item number 2, and item number 2 is a 6-year program update from Rita Buescher, the VDOT Chief Financial Officer. Mal Curley is going to give us a brief update on the National Transportation Safety Board findings on the Minnesota Bridge findings. Very, very important to us. Both nationally as well as some of the facts as they pertain to Virginia. So if everyone's ready, let's go ahead and start with the status report on emergency response and snow removal. We have Jeff Caldwell and Jimmy White here from VDOT, and Jimmy has been on loan to the commissioner for the last several weeks, really going back to February. When we did have a very unfortunate icing incident, and the commissioner directed and has asked me to extend his apologies for not being with you today. He's at an important meeting of the International, Intelligent Transportation Society, the International Society of Internet of that august body in New York. It's been a very long week, and I would say, just as a way of observation, in Virginia, where there is an election every year, there's always about a 60-day lull in business, and the Wednesday after is a harried and difficult time. You'd be amazed the amount of routine things that just kind of got put on hold in this Commonwealth and as a part of those very important changes that are occurring throughout Virginia. So I would say, whether it's my office, whether it's VDOT, whether it's Mr. Tucker's office, the crunch of business is hitting every agency of state government, which is normal after a sort of an election lull, but it comes at a time of extraordinary economic challenge. And for those members of the audience and the media here, just to put this in perspective, it's been a lot about the general fund reductions, which are about 8% a year. That's a very large and really post-war era, almost unique. But transportation is a 10% reduction. And there is often and usually the prospect of economic recovery with general funds, with sales tax and income tax. But the revenue sources that make up what we do in transportation are sources which are permanently shrinking. And so whether it is a great requirement for enhanced fuel efficiency, whether it's the decline in value of used cars, when those are sold, that's a significant piece of our revenue base. Those value changes are permanent, and you'll see in the second presentation today just a glimpse of some of the long-term impacts of that. In the more immediate term, Mr. White is here to brief us about, in this environment, what we can do better and cheaper to avoid costs and to meet our number one priority, which is the safe maintenance and operation of our highway system and our transit and airports and port systems. Thank you, and welcome, Mr. White.
Thank you, Mr. Secretary, and thank you, ladies and gentlemen. I'm happy to be here today. My name is Jimmy White. I've worked for VDOT now for about 40 years. The last 20 of them have been in maintenance and operations. And about 4 or 5 months ago, the commissioner asked me to help him as he led us through our change in focus into emergency response. As you recall, that February 12th ice storm is what really was a catalyst to change our focus. We took some immediate action steps after that to ensure adequate coverage for the Springfield interchange. that actually happened almost immediately after the storm. We also established an aggressive program to improve VDOT's emergency response protocols and practices, and to strengthen our maintenance forces. In April of 2008, the commissioner delivered to the Transportation Board a long-term plan as to how we would move forward over the next 4 to 5 years. VDOT vowed to develop a comprehensive training program for our frontline supervisors and our managers out there to focus on the best practices for available for snow and ice emergencies. While we have a number of emergencies other than snow and ice, being hurricanes, wrecks, and even terrorism, the first one that we focused on was response to snow and ice. We established an emergency response team that was made up of professionals inside VDOT that represented the districts as well as the central office. We've also been working for the last several years as we've reviewed the techniques and technology associated with anti-icing, and really bringing the term anti-icing into our vocabulary has been something different, because through most of my career we talked about de-icing and not anti-icing. Anti-icing is really the prevention of the serious disruption of traffic. De-icing is what you do after you've already lost it and you're trying to get it back. We also developed an improved command and control structure in the implementation of the duty officers. The idea here is to have a responsible person in charge in each of the district 24 hours a day, 7 days a week, 365 days a year. This year we renewed our emphasis on the snow fighters skills competitions around the state, what we used to call our truck radio, and we've developed some new contracts to help us secure the road weather information and our weather forecasting. Our first step, as I said earlier, was for snow and ice response. We've developed and improved the Virginia traffic system, which gives us, it's an internal traffic system, so we've got more situational awareness of what's going on out there on our entire transportation system. We've developed a comprehensive training program to educate our frontline maintenance forces and in the best practices of snow and ice removal and snow and ice prevention. And what we're particularly proud of is over the last 3 months, we've trained more than 150 frontline supervisors and key emergency response managers at our Transportation and Emergency Response Institute. Our Emergency Response Institute was actually developed and delivered by VDOT. We say in the slide we taught it with internal and external industry experts. It was really about 90-95% internal experts and about 5% industry experts out there. We developed the program using the VDOT Learning Center. We specifically focused on anti-icing as a key component of it. And we focused on command and control. The process of taking somebody like myself, who was 20 years a resident administrator, that looked after a 3 or 4 county area in Virginia, and trained that person to look after a whole transportation system that even went across a whole district, or maybe went into 2 districts. We started looking more closely at contracting and procurement, how we could go out there and get services in an emergency to get the road back open. We improved some technology that helps us do our work, and we also worked to improve our our communication system. Anti-icing, we tried to make that a part of our vocabulary. Like I said, anti-icing is the prevention of a bad situation. It's not the response to it. Salt brine is turning out to be the leading technology in the weather that we deal with here in the state of Virginia. Salt brine is very effective. Salt brine ends up opening up the window of opportunity for us to get our folks out on the road in time to deal with the storm. It's very cost effective. It's the most cost effective anti-icing material that's available. And it's pretty easy to make. In most of the districts here in the state of Virginia, we will be manufacturing salt brine ourselves for this winter. The first of it will actually be ready to start around the middle of December. In Northern Virginia, they're not going to be manufacturing salt brine. They'll actually be purchasing that from a supplier, either salt brine or mag fluoride. We've already purchased the equipment. That we're going to be using. A lot of that is being installed now, and we'll have that fully operational here before the end of the winter. Right now, we're planning on doing a little more than 200 miles per district throughout the state, and somewhere more than 1,000 miles of road to be anti-iced in Northern Virginia. On top of that, our TAMS contractors are also using anti-icing technology on their sections of interstate that they have under contract. Quite frankly, the real specific focus is on the Springfield interchange. Some of the technology improvements that we have underway, we are upgrading our RWIS system. RWIS is an acronym for Remote Weather Information Station. That does a couple of things for us. One, it gives us the weather conditions at that particular location, which places like Springfield Interchange or some of the high bridges down in Tidewater, we know exactly what's going on the pavement at that particular time. But the other thing it does for us on a system-wide basis, that ends up being the linchpin or the cornerstone for a much more accurate weather forecasting system. Here before the first of the year, we will have a weather person, meteorologist, that will actually be under contract with VDOT to give us road weather forecasts. An interesting thing about weather forecasts is that, you know, the National Weather Service and most of your weather forecasting system, their forecast ends about 4 feet off the pavement. It doesn't get all the way down to what's happening on the road. Our actual weather meteorologist or meteorologist will be able to give us a forecast for what's happening down at the road level, which is specific to us and helps us really deal with the situation out there. Like I said earlier, we've improved Virginia traffic so that each of us has a better picture of what's going on the rest of the system. So if we have an incident going on in the western part of the state and we have to detour traffic, we don't want to detour them into someplace else that's not going to be able to take care of it. On the communication side, we've repaired and we've enhanced a lot of our very verbal message network. We're also enhancing the VDOT radio communication network. Over the last number of years, that network has got a lot of holes in it. That's vital for our situational awareness of what's going on out there. And our own radio system works when the cell phone system and the other public communication systems actually fail. On top of that, we've improved websites for public information, and we've had a real focus on outreach to the media. And with that, I'll turn it over to Bill.
Welcome, Mr. Caldwell.
Thank you, Mr. Secretary, members of the board. My name is Jeff Caldwell. I'm the Chief of Communications. And the Commissioner asked me today to talk a little bit about what we are doing in terms of sharing information with the public and helping to educate citizens of the Commonwealth about emergency response as a whole and specifically our snow outreach as we go into the winter season. part of our emergency response initiative, when we announced it last year, we said that we were going to do a concerted effort here in the fall and early winter to educate the public about snow preparedness and what they can do to help us out on the roadway. We actually launched that last week with a series of press conferences simultaneously around the state on November 10th that resulted in significant media coverage in all major media markets and several dozen stories, most of which were very positive about the efforts of the agency as a whole and trying to introduce the concept of anti-icing that Jimmy mentioned before. It is something new that motorists are going to see on the highways this year. And we want to make folks understand what it is we're doing when they see those trucks out on the road before a storm spraying a liquid on the roadway. It may look a little strange when they first encounter those trucks, and we want to make sure people understand what we're trying to do there. Of course, a certain number of the stories did focus on the budget with all of the concerns about finance here in the Commonwealth. We did have some media coverage that looked at our snow budget, which was slightly less than last year, and made the correlation to budget cuts. But that wasn't really directly tied together. We still have a very healthy snow budget this year that is on par with what we used in the past. And there was no intention to reduce our snow budget based on the economics of the Commonwealth as a whole. We also went beyond just media coverage to provide resources where motorists could find out more information themselves about our snow removal efforts and emergency response. And that's been a great success for us. The web address is there on the screen. I won't read it to you. But those resources that are available on the VDOT website include some new interactive tools and other messages and resources that are available that folks have really started to pick up. I don't know if anyone's a YouTube user or watching media websites around the state, but a lot of other folks now are co-opting these tools that we've put on and linking directly to them. So we're seeing much more coverage about our snow removal efforts this year than in past years. This is just a quick picture of what the website looks like. You'll see there's a whole bunch of resources down the left side that people can read and watch. And then we also have these videos available that really show motorists what we're doing on the road, what they can expect when they come upon our crews. Of course, our key messages this year, hopefully you've heard if you've been watching any of the press coverage, we have seen a lot of positive coverage focusing on the safety efforts here that are at the heart and soul of our emergency response initiative and, of course, our winter weather efforts. We're trying to emphasize to folks that we are working across the state and will continue a snow removal program in earnest because safety is our number one priority. We will not cut back on services just because of funding. And we will work within our means, but if we have to invest more heavily in ensuring safety, of course the agency is committed to do that, and we will invest all that is necessary to keep the roads safe, depending on the type of winter we get this year. We also want to make sure folks understand what our standards are as we go out and work on the snow removal efforts statewide. And of course, VDOT's standard for a number of years has been to try to make all roads passable within 48 hours of the end of any major storm. And we've tried to explain to folks the priority order with which we approach our roadways. And that really focuses on those major roadways first and those that connect the core services and core areas of the Commonwealth. And you'll hear a little bit more about that later today. And then, of course, talking about anti-icing. There's a bunch of statistics on the board here. You may have seen these pop up all over the Commonwealth as we've tried to explain to the public what resources are available for our services this year. But really this accounts for all of the state-controlled and state employee equipment that's on the road, but also that of our private contractors, be they the TAMS contractors or those contract equipment that are brought in throughout the state to help with secondary roads and other services. We also have tried to quantify some of the chemicals and other materials that are available for our use this year. Folks like to see those statistics, though it might be hard to try to figure out what 234,000 tons of salt looks like. We just try to reassure folks that we do have stocks available and will be there regardless of what Mother Nature throws at us this year. So with that, I'll invite Jimmy back up and be glad to answer any questions if there are.
Thank you, Mr. White. Mr. Caldwell, there are questions. Mr. White. The other Mr. White.
The other Mr. White, yes. I'm going to ask a question to the smart Mr. White. This is very impressive. Is this knowledge being shared with localities that have their own maintenance piece, for instance, cities and those counties that handle their own snow removal? Maybe some of them are using the salt brine anti-icing technique already, but I'm sure there are those who are not. What are we doing in that regard?
At this point, we haven't been proactive about getting the word out to the localities. However, several localities have heard what we're doing and have actually come to us, asked us to provide them with copies of the training that we made that we gave to our folks. So as we move forward, we will be sharing it more with the localities than what we have.
Well, good. I think that's really important because, you know, you mentioned focusing on the Springfield interchange, but there are a lot of people that live in cities and counties that handle their own maintenance function that need to know about this.
So. Mr. Chairman. In looking through your summary data, I note that we have 500 more pieces of equipment than we have people to operate them. That sort of caught me a little bit by surprise. Is that, can you fill me in?
Sure. Happy to. VDOT has many different types of equipment, and I think when you look at that piece of data, that takes into account trucks, motor graders, front-end loaders, and other pieces of equipment. We're a lot of times in the and tractor mowers and other things like that. Some of that equipment is only used during a certain part of the year, summer or fall, and other of it is used during the wintertime. So that's part of the difference that you see there.
In some cases, we might also have some shared equipment. Jimmy mentioned a front-end loader that would be sitting at a salt pile, and as the dump truck driver drives in, he hops out, gets in the motor grader, or gets in the front-end loader, loads his truck, leaves that piece of equipment, then leaves in his dump truck. So in some of those cases, that equipment is redundant and used by more than one employee.
Thank you.
Ms. Coolman.
Thank you. Mr. White, first of all, I'm pleased that you have advanced the operations-mindedness of the department here. I think that's critical going forward. I'm very pleased that you have a systems view, and I'm really, really pleased that you have this Springfield interchange as a focal point. That is a microclimate for these purposes, no doubt about it. And whereas you can look at a response to a storm as 99% good, if you were on the Springfield interchange that day, it was 100% bad. So that's a good metaphor to use going forward. I have two questions. One, which parts of these new weather information resources are going to be add-ons, and are they all add-ons at this point, and are they going to be engineered into future projects or simply retrofitted to everything that they have, where that applies?
I think there are several strategies there. Some of it will be engineered into new projects. Some of it is add-ons for what's already there. In fact, the Springfield Interchange, I think we added 8 sensor locations at the Springfield Interchange just for that. If you look at our plan, where we hope to be 4 or 5 years down the road, we hope to have a network that covers the whole state to do two different things. One, to give the, as I said earlier, one to enhance the weather forecasting. The other thing is to be able to spot those locations where that are critical, tops of mountains, high bridges, and things like that. There's another thing that's not in my presentation, but now's a good time to bring it out. We're going to a system where we can locate our vehicles and be able to get data back from our vehicles. And our anti-icing trucks and our superintendent trucks are actually going to be, over a period of time, outfitted with temperature sensors that can read the temperature on the road and then transmit that back to a control center so that we've got that much more data as to what's going on out there.
Well, I applaud that, too. Mr. Chairman, one other question. Mr. Caldwell, these sort of gross statistics of tons of salt and gallons of liquid, is there a rule of thumb about lane miles that are used there, like, you know, a ton of salt can cover X miles?
I'm sure he can
I think these are good. There's a lot of stuff, and that's a good message. But in terms of how it's used, is this five storms worth system wide? Is it 5 days worth of treatment before you have to reload? Is it?
Okay, that was a harder question than I was prepared to answer. But let me try to answer it. That's not a full winter supply of salt. What happens is as we begin to use it, we start to replenish it. That is in some places that may be enough chemicals to make it through the whole winter. In other places, you have to replenish it as you go along. What I was getting ready to answer before I heard your whole question was that the amount of salt we use per mile changes with the different weather conditions that you have to deal with. It may be as little as 100 pounds per mile, but it could be as high as 650 pounds per mile, depending on the weather conditions.
Final question, Mr. Chairman. Are the costs of these chemicals relatively stable now? Are they going up, going down? What's your view about, what are you anticipating there?
We've actually received several questions about that, because there's been some national stories about shortages, especially up in the Northeast and Midwest, and the increased cost of salt. We are seeing an increase, like any other commodity, because of the shipping costs for all of these supplies. But we did long-term contracts that started this summer and have supplies secured to ensure that we have them. We are seeing cost increases, and we'll have to absorb that as part of our budget as we go forward. But again, that's kind of cost of doing business. We know that we need to put those chemicals on the ground, and we'll have to invest accordingly.
Thank you. Ms. Conley?
Thank you. Because I saw my first snowfall a little bit yesterday in Northern Virginia, I'm very glad to see all this. This is really just fine, putting all this into the regular system, and the daily and seasonal activities of the department, I think, are just wonderful. I was just curious. The anti-icing, and particularly this salt brining technique, seems to have marvelous safety benefits and so on. But I just wondered, does it have any maintenance liability to it? In that, I will leave it at that.
All right. Not really. Actually, we should see some maintenance benefit from it. Because when you use a salt brine to treat the road ahead of time, you end up using a lot less chemical in the long run than what you would in the conventional way we've done it. One of the studies that I meant to say something about but didn't, there was a study done up in the state of Idaho for about 5 years. It ended about 3 years ago. And, you know, when we think about Idaho, we think it's really cold and dreary and much different than Virginia. But this particular road that they studied had weather similar to what we experienced in Virginia. In other words, the storms, the ice events happened between about 28 and 32 degrees, which is pretty normal for us. They had a lot of small snows or small ice events, black ice and frost and that sort of thing. They entered into a de-icing program, and what they found is they improved the crash rate, or they decreased the crash rate by about 80% on that about 40 mile section of road. They decreased the chemical usage by about 80% also on that same section of road.
80,
yes. And they decreased the manpower, the number of hours of man and equipment that they had to use on that particular section of road, by about 60% over that period. The reason why is these storms that we get that are just frost, or they're just a frozen rain or something, many times they found out that by going and having an anti-icing program, that may be the only thing they have to use when to deal with the storm. One of the things that happens with us when we're out there trying to treat a snowstorm or an ice storm in the way that we used to have to do it, we'd go out there and spread dry chemical on the road, and if you follow the truck along, more than half of that dry chemical bounces off and into the ditch or into the gutter or whatever, and it's not effective at all. So this is getting the most effect out of the money that you spend in chemicals that you put on the road. And like I said, in the long run, you'll end up with a maintenance benefit and an environmental benefit too.
Wow.
Win-win.
Any other questions or comments? Yes, ma'am.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. You're going to love the way I'm going to address this, but it's going to be in layman's terms, okay?
Okay.
Here I sat, and I won't tell my age, but you can look at my hands, how old I am. So naturally, I am real excited about the anti-icing. I think it's wonderful. And so during the conversation, I say to average Joe, just like I'm average lady, they said, what are you all going to do? You're not going to have any funding for the maintenance and when it snows and whatever. I said, oh, but we've got this great program now called anti-icing. And they said, anti-icing. That's right. The chemicals would go down first. And they looked at me and they said, well, all that's going to do is melt. And, you know, what's going to fall, and then that's going to freeze over, and then we're going to have black ice by the time evening is here.
Okay.
Yeah. Give me an answer.
What will happen is, let's say we have a forecast this evening for an ice event like you're talking about. By us being able to anti-ice, we can treat that road up to 24 hours before we actually have the storm. Mm-hmm. And what that does for us is, if we have the event like you're talking about, that gets the chemical down and gives us probably 4 or 5 hours after the storm hits for us to get back in there with our regular snow removal equipment. So today, if I have a situation like you're talking about out on Interstate 81, my trucks are usually stationed about 10 to 15 miles apart. Well, if it starts precipitating and the weather and it starts cooling off, I've got to hit that 100% correct 100% of the time, or we're gonna have a problem. And by doing this, it opens up that window of opportunity for me to get out there, so I don't have to hit the target at 100% of the time. If I get it not quite so close, I'm still doing much better than what I'm doing today.
It gives you more time.
It gives me much more time. So really, I'm talking about at least two different types of weather events. One, the one that just puts a little bit of stuff down and doesn't do anything else. And the other one where it puts some down and it continues. So it's another tool in the toolbox for the professionals out there that deal with this all the time to be able to deal with the problem.
Thank you. I have my answer. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Okay. Thank you. Any other questions or comments? Mr. White, Ms. Caldwell, thank you for a great presentation. I would note, a couple of things. The governor has emphasized a culture of preparedness, and we practice that with hurricanes and evacuation. This is part of that, and I really applaud your talking about snow preparedness, because I'll bet everybody at this table has had the experience of, in that first storm of the year, boy, I don't have an ice scraper in my car, and that is so important in the day-to-day practice of transportation. The second is, the governor's got now a commission report on climate change, and a lot of the focus there is on air quality and emissions. But underneath that are some very important issues about sea level rise and also the severity of storms. That is an aspect of climate change that is very significant. And so here is a wonderful example of VDOT getting ahead of that curve and responding to some of those changes through technology and just good, smart thinking. And then the last point, I just want to read one of your key messages on your second to last slide, because most of you are going to get calls about this, but it says there will be no significant changes to levels of service due to budget or any other reason with respect to snow removal. And as VDOT has gone out and talked about this, there have been instances where people are saying, oh my gosh, we're not going to get the same level of service we had last year. I'm betting that as a consequence of this, they get better service, but certainly it will be no worse than previous years. And so to the degree you get calls, you've got it here in black and white in front of you and from Mr. White, who speaks with great authority on this matter. And so I thank you both, and our congratulations to the commissioner on another job well done. Okay, the next item on the agenda is not quite so happy. Rita Buescher, the Chief Financial Officer for the Department of Transportation, is going to give us an overview of the six-year program and also, you know, the budget actions that are necessary to support that. I would say, in fairness, we had hoped to be further along in this process than where we are today. If you have followed the economic news, a revenue forecast that was made in August or early September probably did not take into account some very significant changes in the global and the national and the state economy. For that reason, you'll see the update. There's talking about trends and directions and percentages, but not necessarily the hard numbers that we would like to have in place in preparation for a very unique action, which is a mid-year and substantial revision to the six-year program. Welcome, Ms. Buescher.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, members of the board. As the Secretary indicated, the October estimate of state transportation revenues for the six-year period, fiscal year 2009 through 14, is a $1.6 billion reduction from what we had anticipated July 1. And we hope to get the final, or we will get the final official revenue forecast from the State Department of Taxation in December. So we are still looking at a moving target. One of the biggest uncertainties that we face and that we've mentioned to you over the last couple of months is the federal revenue outlook. Safety Lou expires at the end of the federal fiscal year 2009. In addition to that, we are dealing with the economic downturn, and the current forecast for the Federal Highway Trust Fund indicates that they will, in fact, be out of cash at the end of the 2009 Safety Lou period. The structure and funding levels of the next federal transportation authorizing legislation is also unknown, especially in light of a new president and staff. We are continuing at this point, and this is one of the changes that I'll tell you a little bit about from the last month's presentation. We have decided to forecast the federal revenue growth based on Virginia's estimated fuel consumption growth. And what that means is the federal revenue estimate is based on the last year of the safety loop, or 2009, with annual growth equal to the forecasted growth in the consumption of motor fuel by the Virginia Department of Taxation. So the largest revenue source for the Federal Highway Trust Fund is the gas tax. And since the federal fuel tax is a per gallon tax and states are guaranteed to get a minimum rate of return of 92%, we're using the estimated growth in the sale of gas in Virginia as a sound method for estimating the federal revenue growth. However, to protect from overprogramming our federal funds, we are holding in reserve approximately $424 million as somewhat of a hedge in truly not knowing where the federal revenue picture is going to take us in 2010. All of VDOT's programs will be impacted by the revenue reductions except the snow and ice effort that we talked about a few minutes ago. The revised six-year improvement program will reflect the impact of the revised revenues to the construction and maintenance program. The reductions will be seen in the state formula distributions and in other dedicated and statewide construction amounts. Now, I know this is a busy slide. This is similar to the slide that we showed you about a month ago. We are looking at the reduction over the 6 years being approximately the $1.6 billion that I mentioned in the state revenue. But you'll see the federal revenue line. We are now showing the reduction over the 6 year period of $156 million versus approximately the $550 million we showed before. But we are holding the $424 million in reserve. So our total revenue picture is still at the $2.2 billion level. The other caveat on this slide is where we are in capital improvement bonds. With the downturn in the economy and the funding or the revenue source to pay the debt service on any bonds that we issue as a result of House Bill 3202, those revenue sources are down as well as all other transportation revenues, and that's the insurance proceeds. So we are looking and consulting with bond counsel on debt capacity and what would be the best avenue to take in terms of issuing bonds, not only the amount, but the timing. So we have left that line item on this slide as it was budgeted in 9, 10, and through 14, knowing that we will be coming back to you hopefully in December with revised bond issuance numbers, not only the amount, but the timing of those. So that's why you'll see the note to the side, excuse me, where we say that line will be adjusted. Okay. Estimated construction impact. The interstate program is expected to be reduced by 5 to 10% in the current year, being FY09. And up to 25% in the following fiscal years, 10 through 14. The state formula construction funds for primary, secondary, and urban systems will be reduced approximately 15 to 20% in 09 and up to 45% in FY10 through 14. The total construction program, including dedicated and statewide construction funds, so that means in addition to the formula funds, will see reductions of 5 to 10% in 09 and up to 20% in years 2010 through 2014. Now, the focus that we're making at this point on the addition of the construction program is trying to funding the phases of projects that are underway or are committed to be underway in 09. So anything that is underway coming into this year and anything that we were scheduled to have underway in this fiscal year. We're trying to make sure we fund those. One reason, most definitely, we don't want to end contracts already signed. Secondly, we have to maintain our federal obligation strategy and using and focusing on matching all federal dollars. So priority goal is to not let any federal dollars go unmatched. So those are the priorities at this point. Next steps. In December, at the CTB meeting, we look and hope to bring, with the updated revenue estimates we receive in December, the picture of what it would take to balance 09 and 10 budgets. We will update you on wherever we are in terms of the restructuring of the organization, and we'll be reviewing where we are in service level reductions that are appropriate. And we'll be bringing to you a draft of the revised fiscal year 9 through 14 program reductions. That would mean in January, and this is tentative, we'd be looking at holding public hearings on the revision to the 9 through 14 construction program. And we're looking at approximately five across the state. What's tentative is the timing, whether January is when we're ready to make that happen. And then after the public hearings, we'd be prepared to adopt the revised program. And it's not on the slide, but then we're going to jump into the 10 through 15 program. That's where we are, and I'll be happy to answer any questions.
Ms. Taylor?
Ms. Bush, I would characterize that as a pin drop presentation. Mr. White?
That was a good presentation, even though none of us like the numbers. Can you tell us a little bit how the $424 million reserve fund was, how that amount was arrived at in comparison to the total federal expenditure?
It actually is the difference between just reviewing a revenue estimate, a federal revenue estimate, looking at the gas consumption, the gallon calculation, and looking at what we think our federal obligation amount might be reduced. And when we came back, or last month, we came in saying that instead of budgeting 90% of where we think the federal obligation would come in, we dropped that back to 80%. So the reserve is actually the difference between the gas consumption revenue estimate and that 80% of obligation, giving us, you know, you don't want to be significantly over program, but you also don't want to be under program. You want to make sure you're capturing all your federal dollars. So that difference is that drop from a 90% budget level to an 80% budget level.
Ms. Chairman, one other question. I assume that reserve amount will be adjusted as and when more detail is known.
Absolutely.
Mr. White, if I could add to that, you may recall that Mr. Jack Basso from ASHTO came, and his recommendations were actually far more draconian than that. This is a little bit less than, on average, about $100 million a year going into the reserve. His numbers called for about a $200 million a year reduction in federal revenues to the Commonwealth. So there is some risk, even at this level. But I think it's important to understand, and maybe I want to come back to this and explain some of these things in a little bit harsher terms than Ms. Buescher is doing, but the federal revenue situation is by far the largest question mark in the program. We've never had that before. Other questions? Mr. Kuhlman.
Mr. Chairman, Ms. Buescher, let me ask you this. There's been discussion at federal level of prospect for a package of stimulus package that would include a large infrastructure component.
Yes.
Is there any way for you to factor those discussions into this exercise? If it happens, you'll be pleasantly surprised. It's something we should help push because, for example, if the CTV is taking projects off the plan, clearly they're ready to go, and many of them are ready to go that and could be a part of a stimulus package. What kind of discussions or what kind of thoughts do you have about that?
We actually have a list of projects that we've put together that would qualify for what we understand could be a stimulus package. And not knowing, obviously, the terms of that package in terms of what constitutes a ready-to-go, whether that's it's ready-to-go tomorrow, 60 days, 180 days. Right now, the guidance has been about 180 days. So we've created a list of projects, some of which funding was removed, but that could be ready to go in 180 days. And we have a list of high dollar projects, about 20 funds, but we could put together $1 billion if stimulus brought together.
I would just say, Mr. Chairman, that I have received quite a few comments and suggestions to that effect from people in Northern Virginia who know and have some confidence in some of the new representation that Virginia is sending there, and that we have a new president who may be more amenable to that sort of suggestion. Second question, Mr. President. Mr. Chairman. He's here next pleasure. I heard on the radio that the Virginia Resources Authority was selling bonds. They seem to call them tax-free infrastructure bonds. Some were rated AAA, they said. Some were AA. Is our bond sale, or the bond sale that would proceed under our auspices, coordinated with bond sales of other parts of the Commonwealth? Or is our bond council really working specifically with us?
Specifically with us.
Okay.
This would be a VDOT issue. Yes. Our concern and what we're looking at is simply timing and capacity. But it's just VDOT.
But the Commonwealth transportation bonds all go through the Treasury Board for their review, and they do make recommendations with respect to time, even though Ms. Buescher is correct. It's, you know, it's the bond council and their CTB bonds, but there is a coordination through the Treasury Board. Ms. Conley.
Can I just follow up on that bond, looking at your busy chart? Could you just review for my benefit that we are budgeting, or at least now, at 425 for 09, and then dropping down to 300 for 10, and that's because of the unknown about the insurance premium. Is that?
No, this was how it was budgeted previously when the 09 budget was put into place. Actually, because of the lawsuit. We had authorization to sell bonds in 08 and did not. What we had planned to sell in 08 had carried over to 09, and therefore you have a 425. Normally the amount that we're looking at is 300 million to 200 million on a fiscal year. And the $1.1 billion that you see is just the culmination of 11 through 14. But the 425 is large because as we were waiting for the outcome of the lawsuit, we did not sell in 08.
Right. But we have been affirmed in the lawsuit.
We have. Right now, the downturn in the economy has got us in terms of the source of our debt service payments.
Mr. Chairman, that reminds me of one other question. We have FRAN bonds, I think, still outstanding.
We
federal
do.
Reimbursement anticipation notes, and I've sort of lost track of that program in terms of whether we continue to issue bonds. But for those that are outstanding, what happens as federal revenues diminish? How do we pay those bonds, and what happens?
Those bonds are actually being paid by the insurance proceeds, the state revenues.
Oh, so those revenues from the insurance
are paying for the FRAN.
I see. So no longer does the federal reimbursement back those bonds?
The answer is yes, technically. but there is a backstop of the insurance premium so that there's not a direct, it is not... in a banking sense, dependent on those federal reimbursements. Moreover, we adopted a debt management policy back in 2003 that limited the total FRAN issuance to no more than X percent, I think it was 20% of anticipated federal reimbursement. So, but there's a lot of outstanding FRAN debt. Mm-hmm. As anybody, it's certainly in excess of $1 billion, if I remember correctly.
John.
Mr. Chairman.
John Lawson.
In terms of outstanding, I think it's around $700 million.
$700 million, and the annual debt service on that, any rough? About 150. Mr. McCarthy.
Is that in here under the capital improvement bonds, or is it, where is that?
This is just showing revenue here, and there's no intended sale plan in this.
In the presentation we made in June, there was an allocation slide, and the first thing at the top of that was debt service, including anything that we would have budgeted for the any capital 3202 bond grants and other
Okay.
So this is just the source for the new bonds that we have issued.
Thank you.
Ms. Carter.
Not too, thank you, Mr. Chairman. Not too long ago, I was, don't watch the Congress committee meeting or whatever very often, but I happened to run upon this one, and I guess it was intended for me to do so since I'm very interested in transportation and trying to improve Virginia. But speaking of the stimulus package, the Ways and Means Committee was meeting that evening, and they stated of how much that they wanted to recommend up in the billions of dollars for transportation. And there were, the governor from Maryland was there, and there was other mayors there. In fact, they had visited Hampton Roads. Someone on the committee had visited the Hampton Roads area. And with one of the other gentlemen who was there, you know, speaking for transportation. And they stated they wanted, as I stated a few minutes ago, they wanted to pour billions of dollars into the transportation because that they felt as though that was the way that was really the issue and what needed to get back the people back to work and the economy flowing again. Because there was no way that the economy could increase and people back to work unless transportation was improved. And that they were going to look very favorable upon projects that were ready and that would serve the areas where that transportation would increase the economy and could move goods. And like I stated, they said they had visited the Hampton Roads area in there. So I thought, I don't have to really worry about this, only I want to say this to Pierce, but I know that you would be there.
Well, as we say, trust but verify.
I know. The lady from Washington State, a delegate, and I cannot think of her name. Maybe you can. She's on that committee. And I'm sorry that I can't, you know, think of her name at that time. But they were really, really serious and wanting to pull billions of dollars back into the transportation fund.
Mm-hmm. Well, and again, the reality of the stimulus, there is, even for the federal government, a limit to borrowing. And they're dealing with the TARP program. They're dealing with automobile manufacturers. There's a second round of insurance company requests. Transportation, for better or for worse, is but one of many entities out there seeking federal assistance. So this is, again, I think there's many who have expressed a strong interest and commitment to this, but whether or not the system can produce meaningful additional funding for transportation. There was some hope that could happen here during the lame duck session of Congress. That's clearly not going to happen, so it will be until sometime in January before we know the answer, and maybe well after that. Any other questions or comments? Ms. Kuhlman.
One additional comment, Mr. Chairman. And I'm struck by the sort of tale of two reports here. Mr. White's emergency response report was not only good but well received because it was realistic, it was courageous, it set goals, stated objectives, and pledged to do what was necessary to meet a challenge, regardless. In other words, the resources would be appropriate for something that Mother Nature compels us to respond to. And I'm a little bit perplexed about this report, which leaves us, you know, human nature being what it is as opposed to Mother Nature, our inability as this body and as the department to actually respond to a set of circumstances we know demand a response. So I'm just a little bit perplexed, and I'm not sure, but we know that these things don't self-correct in any immediate future. As His Eminence Robert Vaughn observed, there's no low-hanging fruit left. We know we have to do something different on the revenue side, and yet we're sort of trapped in the ice of our own indifference.
An apt metaphor. If I might take a little liberty to go back and highlight a couple of points, but importantly to understand, these slides are not numbered, but the third page in, entitled Revenue Outlook, which talks and says the current forecast for the Federal Highway Trust Fund indicate it will be out of cash at the end of the current federal fiscal year. Let's stop and think about
what
that.
What page are you?
Page 3. This is exactly where we were on September the 5th of this year when the U.S. Secretary of Transportation called all 50 secretaries and said, even though you have entered into billions of dollars worth of construction contracts on the premise of getting 80 cents back on each dollar you invest, I don't have any money to repay you. And under the current forecast on October the 1st, at the end of the federal fiscal year, they will be out of cash, and maybe even before then. And it took $9 billion just to patch that. We don't know if $9 billion is enough. And understand this, this is not a surprise. When Congress adopted Safety Lou, they adopted a bill that drew down accumulated balances in the Highway Trust Fund. And the federal government has been spending about 25% more per year than they can actually afford in terms of the revenues coming in. This was built into the legislation. In fact, the U.S. Chamber of Commerce over 2 years ago commissioned a report that said you're going to go broke sometime in 2008 or 2009, and they were absolutely right on the money. But if you think about what we have been through, and those of you who have been on the board for a while, the one thing that has been a constant, we've been able to predict federal revenues. We've never had this experience previously. So there are no rules, and this is very significant. But go back to what the gentleman from AASHTO said at our last meeting, which is if federal government simply went on a pay-as-you-go basis, we would cut federal revenues by about 25%, just right off the top. So that's the magnitude of what we're facing there. Now, there were also questions about the reserve amount. That may be too small. Maybe it's too large. I hope it's too large. But there, as Ms. Buescher was saying, we're trying to strike a balance between meeting our obligation authority, which means being a little optimistic, but over-programming is dangerous, and that's where we were in the year 2000 and 2001. So this is a very, very risky situation for this body, which our first and foremost obligation, obviously, is financially. The last point I'd like to make is on that busy chart where Ms. Buescher talked about the bonds. And again, House Bill 3202 authorized $3 billion in debt, about $300 million a year. There is no way that level of debt can be supported with the shrinkage of the underlying revenues. The underlying revenues are the insurance premiums. And is it 20% less? Is it 30% less? We don't know. But it is a very, very substantial reduction to that amount. And those are among the most flexible funding sources that we have, those bond proceeds. I'd also like to highlight the estimated construction impacts. That middle bullet says state construction formula 15 to 20%, up to 45%. That pertains to state revenues. And there are, as you know, federal and other revenues that go in there. So don't automatically assume there'll be a 45% reduction in your secondary allocation. That's just the state portion. If you have a county that has 100% state funding in its secondary program, then it will be at that amount. It may be less, it may be more if you have, say, a Fairfax County that has a large number of federal aid projects in their secondary program. We didn't talk a lot about under next steps, but the budgeting. Commissioner is still finalizing his recommendations. He did give you a blueprint at our last meeting that talked about very substantial personnel and service level reductions. That's going to be a part of it. Those have a ways to go in terms of their development. But things like snow removal and bridge inspection and repair will not be compromised. There are a lot of other things that will be. And some of the organizational changes, if you all recall the joys of the area headquarters consolidation, that will be joyful compared to what we're about to go through. And so I would encourage you to stay in touch with the commissioner's staff and your district administrators, because there are going to be some very, very tough choices. The first of those will begin at the December meeting and probably roll through to January and perhaps even into February. And on that cheery note, I'd like to add an item to the agenda. Mal Curley, our chief engineer, is going to give us a brief overview of the findings of the National Transportation Safety Board regarding the Minnesota bridge collapse. There's a handout in your place.
I don't have a presentation, but I have put a four-page handout at the desk. Carol did it on my behalf. It's front and back. Last Thursday and Friday, the National Transportation Safety Board held a hearing and issued their report on the probable cause of the collapse of the I-35 bridge. It was due to inadequate capacity due to a design error, which failed under a combination of substantial increases in the weight of the bridge due to modifications over the life of the bridge and the traffic and concentrated load that was on the bridge at the day of the collapse. It also said contributing to the design error was the quality control of the consultant and the inadequate design review by federal and state officials. And also contributing to it was the generally accepted practices among federal and state transportation officials on giving inadequate attention to gusset plates during inspections, condition of distortions, etc. The first page, front and back, is the news release from that meeting last week. The next couple of pages in gives the executive summary, gives the conclusions that were reached, gives a recommendations both for the Federal Highway Administration and for the American Society of State Highways officials to address this. And on the back side of the last page is a little update of what we have been doing since the third technical advisory was issued last January. I remind the board there were three technical advisories issued after the collapse. One had to do with inspecting the existing deck truss bridges. We at that time had 11, and as you are aware, that we did do that. The second one had to do with construction loadings on bridges. It recommended that we review what we were doing. Byron Colbert working with Ken Wallace, we reviewed that. We felt that our specifications covered it. However, we did add item in our specifications to clearly clarify construction loads on bridges. The third had to do with the load carrying capacity considerations of gusset plates, and this page right here gives you an update of what Ken Wallace and Anwar Ahmad had been doing. And Anwar is in the back there, and I'd like to thank him for his efforts. He's the Assistant State Structure and Bridge Engineer that heads up our maintenance and inspection area, and he has been at the forefront of the last year, actually ever since he's been in that position, but the last year. He used to be the bridge safety inspection engineer up in Fredericksburg. But he's been working with the Federal Highway Administration, and we have worked very closely with the Federal Highway Administration. Very fortunate our relationship with the people here in the bridge program to establish exactly what we need to do. If you look on here, there's 126 bridges statewide that fit in this category that we're going to have to look at. One's on the interstate. It happens to be the one outside 95 bridge over the James River. I wanted to do this by systems to show that a lot of these are on the secondary system, small bridges. Anwar and Ken, working together with the FHWA and the district bridge engineers, have set up a priority issue. One of the things that was very important is that once the technical advisory was issued, you could run out and do a lot of things. You might not be doing the right things. So that's why we worked very closely with the federal government. From a national viewpoint, in the May meeting, working with the Federal Highway Administration and with Gary Allen, the research aspect that Gary participates for, is we were able to get about $250,000 that the federal government matched $250,000 to move forward some research in the Gusset Place to ensure that what we're going to inspect and what we're going to look at is the right things we should be looking at. And if you notice, if you get a chance to look at the recommendations, you'll see that the safety board recognized that we didn't wait for their study to come out. We're out there addressing what we can. The other thing I'll report to the board is that since that time, we continue to, we've done 10,000 or 11,000 bridge safety inspections. We continue to do that. We continue to emphasize the safety and the bridge program. And as I was talking to the secretary the other day, that's why you might see things posted. That's why you might see things closed. And I received a phone call the other day from an AP reporter who asked me, he said, you know, this report's going to come out and it's going to say it really wasn't the inspection program. Does that give the states relief then on the inspection program? And my comment to him was, it's a core function, bridge safety inspection. And as the secretary, I think, mentioned just a few minutes ago, those are things that we will continue to do and not cut, even though we are in some interesting times, let's say. I'd be happy to take any questions, sir.
Questions for the chief engineer.
Quick question, Ms. Kuhlman. Mal, is this description, steel truss bridges with gusset plates, is this a preferred design going forward now, or does this affect that whole use? Or does it, in your mind, restrict it to secondary where capacities would be lower, say, than...
Yeah, I asked Anwar, and he put together, I have a list of all 126, and I've asked him to put it together from when the bridges were designed. What you see now, most of these type of structures we're using now are very small, I'll say prefab American bridges. You'll see them on small secondary type roads. You know, they're probably... a robust bridge for that type of thing. You don't see it a lot on major. As you look here, we only have one on one interstate. The Coleman Bridge down in Hampton Roads, obviously, is one of these two. So I think you don't see a lot of them, and it's represented in 126 out of 20,000 that we have.
Okay, any other questions or comments? Thank you so much, Mal. I would note for posterity, particularly with Mr. Dickens' arrival and Mr. Witt here, the closure of the Jordan Bridge, which is one of four bridges crossing the southern branch of the Elizabeth River. It joins the King's Highway Bridge as a bridge that has been closed and that will be knocked down and no capacity to replace. This is a bridge that serves the Atlantic Fleet, the private contractors that are uniquely qualified to serve the Atlantic Fleet, and a number of other major employers in the Hampton Roads region. This is very troubling, and no relief in sight. So we know we are that our safety is protected, but we don't have a plan B in place for these types of situations. Thank you, Ms. Crowley. The next item, number three, is the asset management capital needs analysis. Mr. Pitter, welcome. And we're a little bit behind schedule. If we could move these along, I know we have some things we need to get to this afternoon and evening. That will be wonderful.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Today I wanted to provide the board with an update on our asset management process and system and our capital needs projection forecasting model that we've been working on. This is just what I'm going to go through, background, define asset management, take you through our business process, system, functionality, and concept that we're working on, and then go through key outcomes, take you through next steps, and then give you a real quick demonstration of where the system is currently. If you remember, the spring of 2007, we did an organizational assessment, and in that assessment, one of the key findings was the need for DRPT to increase its ability to do economic and financial benefit analysis, primarily focusing on managing assets and the measurement also of statewide needs with respect to asset replacement. As a result of that, in April of that year, y'all allocated funds for numerous projects, one of which was the development of an asset management process and resulting application to assist the department in this endeavor. And finally, the other background item I wanted to touch on was at your last meeting, y'all adopted the Transit Sustainability and Investment Policy, which this is a direct item from that policy, which dictates that we shall use an asset management system in our allocation process beginning with fiscal year 10. The definition of asset management is a strategic, systematic process of operating, maintaining, and expanding physical assets through their life cycle. Our system is primarily focused on the first two items of operating and maintaining. Expansion will be analyzed using a different process. Key principles of asset management are it needs to be policy-driven. There need to be clearly defined goals and objectives that drive the desired outcomes. Those objectives should be performance-based, meaning that they should be able to create performance measures that will provide feedback on how we're doing towards those goals and objectives. Should provide the opportunity to do funding scenarios or the analysis of trade-offs and options. The decisions that you make from an asset management system, there's a need for strong information underlying those decisions. And finally, as in any real system, you need to have a good monitoring system and a feedback to improve that over time. This flow chart, you should have, a little bit hard to read the words, you should have a handout that has this flow chart. It also takes the flow chart and breaks it into a word document of the flow. But basically, I just want to run y'all through, which is really our process that we've developed, which beginning, and I also want to give the time frame, so that beginning in the summer of each year, we're expecting our grantees to enter all of their asset information, and really that's just a cutoff point. We actually expect them on an ongoing basis to be taking assets out as they dispose of them and adding assets to this database as they purchase them. But we have a cutoff of the middle of the summer as a point in time where then we would go ahead and proceed with forecasting needs based on those assets, which that would be maybe in the August time frame each year. Next, at that point, we would share that information with our grantees so that they could utilize it in developing their six-year plan, their capital budgets. And then, in turn, we would ask them in the fall to submit their six-year plan to us, whereas previously we had asked for that information later in the spring, early spring. Now we're moving that forward. And then that allows us, after they submit that capital plan, to compare the capital plan that our grantees have as where they think they're going to the actual forecasted needs that we have projected from the data that we've received from them. And then that gives us the December-January time frame before applications are turned in to reconcile any differences. And there can be explained differences. A grantee may have an opportunity to buy buses under our existing contract at a lot better price, so it may be that a one-year advance of a certain number of buses would be permissible to take advantage of better pricing. Other differences that could come up in this are the expansion assets that I mentioned earlier. Our system is looking at maintenance of assets, the existing assets, and if the system's coming in to buy six expansion buses, that wouldn't be being projected with our system. After that process, we get back to our normal process where we're getting grant applications in February. Then we'll take those applications. The system we're developing will allow us to do various funding scenarios and analysis of different funding options. And then from there, we will proceed with presenting to you a recommended program as normal. And then at that point, this whole process starts over. And just in summary, the system is going to allow us to forecast capital needs for existing assets to maintain those assets. It will allow us to do funding scenarios of how to best fund those assets to get to the policy goals and objectives that y'all have set forth. And then finally, it will help us evaluate our grant applications, streamline that administrative process. And it'll also, a real key point here, is it'll provide a lot more accurate information in our six-year plan. In the past, the out years, the last 3 years of our six-year plan, there had always been what we felt was a deficiency where our capital needs tended to tail off instead of, at a minimum, staying constant or maybe growing that you would expect. So we'll have a lot better six-year forecasting. The next few slides are really just sample slides, and I'm going to go through these. We're actually going to do like a real quick five-minute demo of where the system is. I'm just going to breeze through these. The outcomes, these are pretty intuitive, realistic short-term and long-term forecasting, improved cost effectiveness and use of resources, which in the longer term should give us lower cost. It'll streamline our administrative processes. And finally, the information. And an example of the information, or the power of the information, would be if we had a disaster such as a hurricane that was expected to hit the Hampton Roads area. You know, a lot of times, you know, in that instance, we could be called upon to provide information of how many buses are available from transit providers in the area to help evacuate people. And today, we have to go, or before, we had to go and make phone calls, you know, and scramble to get that data, whereas now we'll actually be able to run some quick reports and be able to provide more timely information and more accurate information. Next steps, we are still in the process of finalizing the, you know, this is something that's never happened before, so we had to go to all our grantees and say, give us your asset data. So that was something new. It's taken a little while. We're probably 85-90% of the way there. We have a few grantees still left to get the data from. The data that we have, we are still reviewing it for accuracy. So hopefully in the next month or so, we'll finalize that inventory data. And the same thing with our capital budget data that we had to get from our grantees. At that point, by mid-December, we'll have completed testing the system itself and should have done internal training and be able to run out the first version of the system within our agency. And from there, we'll be able to do the projections and get back on the flow chart just several months behind, with this year being really the test year of how this system will actually integrate with our existing process. And then next year being the year, the fiscal year 10 of mentioned before, where we actually will have it in place throughout the process. But we get to January, we'll be able to analyze projections, compare them to budgets, get with our grantees, hopefully a little before their applications, work through any large differences, and from there go through our normal process, which leads to the development of our capital allocation plan. With that, I'm going to hold the questions until the end, but we're going to do a real quick demonstration to just show you a little bit of where the system's at and some of the data that potentially can provide.
Okay. And while Steve is queuing that up, this is not the most glamorous item in the world, but this is a very, very important step in parity between transit and highways. We spent a lot of time talking about highway maintenance. This is a tool that will allow us to determine, one, if we are properly maintaining our transit assets to the same level of our highway assets, and two, during a budget process, when you look at the grant applications that you award every year, are you making progress on that? Are we hitting our targets in terms of average fleet turnover? Or is the average age of a over-the-road coach 14 years? Is it 7 years? Those things matter in the real world, and you are spending tens and in some cases hundreds of millions of dollars on these investments without really knowing their cumulative impact. So this is a very important, Mr. Tucker, just a, I know you've been preaching this, and I would say going into an individual transit operator and asking for data sometimes is not an easy question. Trust me, we're from the state. But this is a very important investment of DRPT's time, and it's only as good as the data in it. So we're going to have to work every year to make sure that we keep the data pace accurate.
Yeah, and I just wanted to add to you, there's a number three big benefit is the dollar savings. Well, more money is going to be made available to our grantees. And I'll just give the example because I've lived it myself, having worked in the transit system up the road. There are transit systems that come into our program and will request bus purchase in a fiscal year, and with the intent of not necessarily purchasing those buses in that specific fiscal year from a perspective. They haven't gotten a local commitment. And what will happen is, historically, we've had grantees carry money over for a number of years. But what's the real impact? The person or transit system that wants to get a bus truly this year, their overall capital match percentage has been reduced because someone is tying up that money for asset they may not be ready to replace or have the funds replaced. So to me, the essence of this system is that we're putting more money in all of our grantees' projects by saying that you can only come in for a capital item when it's time to be replaced, so that we can get more money into the program and use that money in the best way to the benefit of our transit system. That, to me, is the biggest benefit, that we think we're going to put more money in local government pockets.
Great example.
Okay. With that, I just want to introduce our manager of financial programming, Terry Brown. She's been one of the leads on this project and helped a great deal with it, and she's going to run you a quick demonstration.
Okay. Welcome, Ms. Brown. Good luck.
Thank you. Yeah, we've been living and breathing this system, and we're within a few days of getting what our consultant who's been building the system likes to call the final version, what we'll call the final untested version. And we'll be training everybody at DRPT next Monday on the system. Matt hasn't accepted his invitation to that training yet. So this will be installed on all of our desktops for all of our technical assistance folks who work over in public transportation, and all of the folks that work over in the programming and financial sections. So the first page we have here is our capital needs, and as Steve's already told you all the cool stuff that this system does, so I'll just show you the pictures. You can see here that we have, right down in here, we have all of the FTA codes. And we have the bus, rail.
That would be Federal Transit Administration.
Thank you very much.
One thing, don't anybody take this data
right
and run with it, because as I said, we're still cleaning, purging data.
Exactly. And as soon as everybody's trained on this, what our technical assistance folks are going to be doing is going out and meeting with the grantees to validate some of this data, because we have been getting all of the grantees to enter this information, and as Steve pointed out, it's all new to all of our grantees too. So we expect that there's going to be a lot of misinformation in here, but everyone's really been participating and giving us a good faith effort, and we appreciate that. So we have our what we like to call super FTA codes here: bus rolling stock, rail rolling stock, and what you've got across the top here is 25-year horizon of our needs. These needs are calculated on, right now, on the FTA useful life based upon the type of vehicle. Okay. We can also change the way that they are calculated right up here. Right now it's based on the useful life. We can also change it to include mileage. And if you look over here at the 2009 number, the 125 million, I'll change it to the useful life with mileage. And it changed to 156 million. So that means that we're expecting that some of those will go a little bit higher mileage, so they'll need to be replaced a little more often. And the one that we'll probably use is what our consultant likes to call, and what I just like to use because I know this word now, the stochastic method. And that just means that there's a smoothing factor that has been built in, assuming that a bus will be built, will be replaced within plus or minus two years of when we think it's going to be replaced. And that smooths out the replacement cycle. So this gives us our needs. You see up here we've got all activities and all grantees. we can also take it out of the super FTA code and we can just look at bus rolling stock. And that'll break it down to the different types of buses. So we can tell you, if you, one of you all should call us and say, how many 40-foot buses are you all planning to buy in 2010? We can tell you 43. Obviously, this is not fully got all the data in it, as Steve said. We can tell you that we need 43 buses for $16 million. Okay. There's also this area up here, which says show spare ratio adjustment. One of the things that Matt and Steve were talking about is we're trying to help our grantees reach the appropriate operating level of having not only the buses that are the appropriate age level and not having to try and operate with a bus that's falling apart, but also that they need to have an appropriate number of spares. And the FTA has guidance on what that spare ratio is. So the, right now with that checked off, there's a spare ratio built in for each system. Okay. Moving on to the capital budgets, which we've asked them to put in. Every year now, moving forward, we'll be asking them to give us this information as of September 30th. And you can see here, and I'll go back up to the super FTA level. So for all bus rolling stock, according to what the information is right now, and this database was pulled down as of November 15th, in 2010, our capital budgets were $26 million. And that means that of all of our grantees, we had $26 million indicated to that's what our grantees would be asking us for in capital applications when our capital grants open up in December 1st. If we go in and look at a particular grantee, here's City of Harrisonburg. And we can see, for example, we can ignore 2009 because we didn't have a capital budget for them because that's what we're in now. But you can see right here, for 2010, they've put in a capital budget of $2.6 million. And according to the system, which has all of their assets entered into it, the system is telling us that, well, they really ought to be asking for $2 million instead of $2.6 million. So one of our technical assistance folks, when they go out there to talk to them about this, they'll be saying, well, what's the difference? Well, one of the things we can do up here is the difference between cost and units. So I can switch to units. And when I do that, I can see that, well, the system says they need 6 buses, and the budget says that they're asking for 6 buses. So I can go down into the detail, and perhaps they've changed from a 30-foot bus to a 40-foot bus, which is more expensive. Or perhaps they've asked for a hybrid bus or a different fuel type. So those are all things that can be investigated now from our technical assistance staff. And then, of course, going out here, you can see that, well, in 2012, they're asking for what their needs are calculated as, but in 2013 and 14, they're not asking for anything. But according to our system, they're going to have 11 buses that are becoming older. So again, that'll be something that'll be coming up in conversation. And then finally, just to show you these couple of screens here, these are our grant evaluation screens. Go back up here to all grantees. And each of our grants, each of our capital grants is a line item. And so this one right here, you can see Star Transit has requested a grant. They want to purchase one replacement van for $53,000. And these are all of our new tools to play with. And we will be grading them on asset management, their compliance with our 6-year plan, what they've basically told us in their capital budgeting information, the public benefit model, which you all have seen, the DRPT assessment, which is our technical assistance folks, their evaluation of, as Matt was saying, are they ready to spend the money, are they ready to buy the bus, or are they just trying to pool money, and then the other, ever popular other. And then the policy page is where we can take our funding and then figure out, especially in this day and age when we're not sure how much money we're going to have from day to day, we can take this and we can figure out, well, if we want to have a targeted match for, let's say, buses are the thing that we value the most, to keep our, and remember this is all replacement stock, as Steve was saying, then we can say, well, we would like to match the buses at 80%. And what that'll do is everything below that will then fill in, as right here it filled in at 62.4%. Well, maybe we think 62.4% is not quite good enough. So we might say, well, we can live with 75% at buses, and then we'll see what else happens. So we can play with all these percentages to see what kind of funding policy we can come up with. So I know that was pretty fast, but it's a little picture of what we're pretty excited about it. It's going to give us more tools to figure out how to spend the money wisely.
Mr. Keene.
Mr. Chairman, I believe we're beginning to see the valuable return on an $11 million investment we made probably in 06. And the way we made that investment shocked everyone in this room when Barbara and Matt swept corners and come up with $11 million to start this process. And you can see how far we were in the dark at that point, and what a tremendous asset this is moving forward to be able to make those decisions where to put those dollars, and in particular to make recommendations in other areas such as the decisions that the Rail Advisory Board's got to make on funding those dollars as well, recommendations from that group. So this gives you more confidence that you can really look at what the needs are going to be and how much you're coming short. At least you begin to know and put some numbers out that you can back up as far as our future needs. So I'm really happy to see this and think it's a great improvement with that investment that we made, that even Mr. White got some policy changes.
I'm sure all of DRPT and Mr. Tucker would gladly accept that. That was a tough conversation to kick this off, and I know we all appreciate the vote of confidence, and it is starting to pay off. There's no question. Mr. McCarthy.
I think it's a very interesting concept to pay as you go, sort of, for the buses, for example, instead of accumulating money for them. Is there any further advantage in aggregating that? Is there any economy of scale? Like, if you know in any given year there are going to have to be 35 buses purchased around the state, can we help in the way of contracting or anything like that?
Absolutely. And in fact, part of what we're doing with the system is now we're developing a statewide procurement for buses of all types. And we believe that as we go out on statewide procurement for buses, 40-foot, 20-foot, 30-foot vehicles and small paratransit-type vehicles, that we'll be able to have greater leverage and bargaining power. And it also will streamline, because for so many of our grantees, Mr. McCarthy, they have trouble putting together specifications to purchase a vehicle. So now that we're doing it, it will help control our asset management system in terms of getting the vehicles delivered, but we should also be able to accrue a cost savings since we're going to be purchasing a larger number of vehicles. Same thing with facilities. We'll now be able to better group facilities as well and get a better understanding of what the costs are, what are the implications of different phasings of projects. And I guess the final thing I would say about this is, from my perspective, one of the key things that I did not like when I came on board at DRPC was I didn't feel we were as transparent as we needed to be about our grant-making process and decision-making process. Because really, at the end of the day, we were just coming to you with the aggregate number. What this does, really, on the policy side, is not for us. It's really for the CTB in its consideration of allocation decisions. We'll now be able to run different scenarios. We could set, as you've adopted at your last meeting, that maintenance of your existing assets was your top priority. What that means from now on is that if you want to say the top priority in fiscal year 2010 is replacement of buses and everything else is a lower level, we can now segregate out, fund buses, let's say, at 80% and fund other capital items at a lower percentage. So really what this is about is transparency and giving you opportunity to make better decisions about how we should allocate funds.
Okay. Thank you very much, and a wonderful presentation. The next item, and closely related to this, is the Transit TDM program application guidance. Corey Hill is here. Welcome, Mr. Hill.
Okay, I've got about 10 slides, but I can cut it to 5. So I'll be very brief.
As you know, brevity is the soul of wit.
Absolutely. I can't wait for my reward. But thank you for the opportunity to come before you. I am going to try to connect some of the dots in terms of what we've been talking about today. We've been doing a lot of things at the ERPT, thanks to your support, and this is another piece of that puzzle that I'm going to just touch on quickly. Just real quick, we're going to talk about program application guidance. What is it? Why do we need it? And what are we doing with it? As many of you all recall, item 449E of the Appropriations Act required DRPT to do many things. Local maintenance of effort, transit sustainability, public benefit, asset management, and we needed to incorporate all this into our programs, which was a complicated endeavor. You all took the first step last month when you passed the Transit Investment and Sustainability Policy. That was the key framework for putting those principles into place. And so that's part of what we're talking about today. We will obviously, as Matt was just saying, want to improve the application process by providing more information to everybody on how does everything work and being fully transparent about that. The guidance is the tool by which we inform our stakeholders, and we've got about 140 of them in terms of the number of grantees statewide. So we've got a lot of potential grantees out there. This is our tool for informing them about changes to the programs and, again, documenting the process for transparency, efficiency, and effectiveness. Now, just on the transit and the transportation demand management side of the house, we've got our rail side of the house, which has got 3 programs on transit and transportation demand management. When I say TDM, I'm talking carpooling and vanpooling, essentially. We've got 15 programs. We've got 7 on the federal side, 8 on the state side, and the way they basically fall into is they fall into 3 categories. They're either related to planning, capital, or operating. And so that's really what our focus is in those areas. Now, you all are very familiar, obviously, with the 6-year improvement program process, but this is a more detailed flowchart just to let you see in one page and one snapshot how do all these things that DRPT has been talking about, how are they going to fit into our process before we come to you with a draft program? And that's really the bottom half of this flowchart shows you where we've got the 4 boxes kind of next to each other there. You see asset management, which Steve just talked about, transit service design guidelines, which we've talked about before, public benefit model, which you'll likely hear about next month, and then right above it, the program specialist evaluation is our staff evaluating the applications. And so all of those come under the investment policy that you all passed last month. The application guidance is the information source that the grantees read about to understand when they think about putting in an application, these are all the things we're going to use, and this is the process your application is going to go through as it travels through the process to get to the CTB and potentially be allocated for funds. Again, the investment policy, I won't cover that. We've talked about that. In terms of the structure for each program, again, in light of transparency here, every one of those 15 programs in the document will describe what the program is, what you have to be in order to be an eligible recipient, expenses, what are the match ratios because they're different for every program, what's the process. You put an application in, what tools are we going to use to evaluate it, and then what procedure do you follow when you submit that application. The evaluation criteria, again, this is something to be more transparent about and for you all to understand. When we come to you with recommendations, what have we done to look at these applications and evaluate them, and what goes into making it a positive recommendation from us to you? And these are the criteria that we use for almost all programs. In terms of implementation for this year, we expect to issue the guidance in its final form next week. We did share a draft of the guidance with our 140 stakeholders earlier in the fall, allowed them a chance to comment on it, so this is not news to them. This is something that they're anticipating and eager to get their hands on. We did get positive feedback, but they're looking for this kind of guidance document from us. The grant application period begins December 1st, and applications are due by February 2nd. From there, we'll spend February analyzing all the applications, using all these tools we've talked about, in a very sophisticated way, and then we'll be coming to you with a recommendation in March. So with that, I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Thank you, Mr. Hill. Questions? Okay. Thank you so much. And then the last of the triumvirate presentations here today. But again, we're laying the analytical framework that Matt has developed for investment decisions. And with us is Mr. Kevin Page to talk about the allocations of the Rail Enhancement Fund, which ultimately are incorporated into the six-year program. I would also note, too, our liaison to the Rail Advisory Board is Mr. Keene, who may chime in periodically as well.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, members of the board. This must be DRPT day at CTB because I have both items 5 and 6 as well. As we've gone through our six-year improvement planning process, as this board may remember in the 09 to 14 allocations in the six-year plan, on the Rail Enhancement Fund, we set out blocks of funds. And then we came in that explanation as to the reason why we did that was we were going to move forward with a strategy for resource allocation as to how we were going to develop the six-year program and come back on a project-by-project basis. This is the next iterative process that we're sharing with the board today. It's an update on our six-year improvement plan rail allocation process as from how we've carried forward since the development of our draft statewide rail plan. As this board may recall, in July of this year, we published our draft statewide rail plan. And from that release, we conducted 5 public meetings across the Commonwealth of Virginia to receive input from the public and the citizens and localities as well. In that plan, as part of the VTRANS update and this process has moved forward, we identified $4.7 billion of potential projects that we felt that would be a vision of moving Virginia forward. Since that time, we've gone back to our funding partners, the railroads, the commuter rail operators, and Amtrak as well, and we've developed a more robust plan that is a move-forward vision strategy that develops a $6.5 billion proposal of needs and costs to develop what we consider to be a good vision for rail in Virginia. I want to be clear to Mr. Chairman, members of the board, this does not carry forward plans for the Metro Rail, Light Rail, or the Short Line Rail Preservation Projects, because that's all part of a different funding strategy as well. Since the release of the plan, as this board knows as well, we've heard many presentations over the past couple of months about the downturn in the economy. This made it difficult for us to work and move forward with a six-year program as well, because we're dealing with competing downturns of the economy as well as updating different interests from the rail as how we move our projects forward. All that demand for passenger rail continues to rise. Again, we have that $6.5 billion out there for a 2035 number. And just falling back on the rail plan, some of our challenges that we've identified. You know, our rail tracks in Virginia are privately owned by freight rail companies. In order for us to move forward, we'll find as well that we are not a passenger leader as Europe is, but yet we're a freight rail leader, unlike our European countries. As we move forward with that, Amtrak has its ability to operate under federal statute on rail systems in the United States and Virginia included. And we also find that commuter rail operators have to compete for capacity where Amtrak tends to have a little bit greater ability to do that through its federal authority. And at the end of the day, we also need to move forward with our visions of public-private partnerships, which is the foundation of our Rail Enhancement Fund and the process and strategy as how we move to improve rail, both for passenger and freight opportunities in Virginia as well. All lying into that, Mr. Chairman, members of the board, this is our approach, our vision approach as to how we want to develop a six-year improvement plan and allocations as we move forward. Very similarly, we're trying to weave into this the VTRANS footprints as well. It's because we're trying to weave a transportation system and network for Virginia, and this is how we feel that rail fits into that. Through reducing congestion, conserving our energy consumption, improving public safety, air quality, making timely and cost-effective travel time alternatives as we weave into our transit-oriented development communities, increasing mobility and improving the quality of life for all Virginians. You know, we also want to provide a cost-effective freight shipping alternative, and this board has been very ambitious in moving forward with some freight rail projects as well, like the Harlan Corridor Initiative and the Crescent Corridor, first phase of the I-81 truck diversions from Manassas to Front Royal. And again, we want to make sure that we're providing another transportation choice during emergency situations. Rail transportation is a very key opportunity as well. Since we are a coastal state, we need to also take that into consideration. So step one of our process was, as we looked at that vision, we went back to our rail plan, and then we worked forward to follow the CTB policy goals. This Transportation Board may recall that these are the goals that move forward as to how we develop projects under the Rail Enhancement Fund. These are very good leading principles in these goals. We need to make sure, first of all, we like to make sure that it's a transportation project that will have some effectiveness in the entire transportation system. And we like to put that one at the top, although that's not number one on the list. But we do want to make sure of that. We need to make sure that we are accelerating investments in Virginia. We're not just subsidizing what is there today. We want to accelerate enhancements for transportation in Virginia. Look at what's in the addressed in the regional, local, and statewide plans, as well as encourage competition like we have participated in the Maersk APM Terminals Dual Access Project through the Commonwealth Railway line purchase and the Median Rail Project, and how we've moved forward with those aggressive steps to help put competitive transportation services out in Virginia. As we move through the rest of these, we want to make sure we're not limiting the Commonwealth to a long-term investment strategy. We like to make sure that we're getting quick, good turnaround projects over a somewhat short period of time that gives us the highest benefit in public interest in retaining our public interest in those private facilities. We also want to make sure that we are constructing projects and not just continuing plans. So as we move forward to step two, we looked at what was out there today from a revenue perspective. As you can see, we had $268 million that we could work with. It's down about 7%. Like you've heard earlier with the previous presentations, our revenues are on the downturn as well. Another takeaway we have here is that we needed about $17 million to develop and move forward some operating subsidies for a three-year administration project that I'll speak to in a minute. So then we move forward with what we consider to be, we've gone from the larger schematic of eight component project functions as to how we break those into smaller pieces. And from those smaller pieces, as we've heard earlier today in Mr. Hill's presentation, we always look for public benefits and moving forward to those key public benefits under a steady state as to what we'll be developing through these projects. What you'll see in cost of components is a description basically of what we are going to be bringing back to this board on a project-by-project basis, but in a generalized fashion you're going to see today what we feel in these corridors are improvements we'll be bringing back to the board. And of those improvements, we show what the total costs are and some of the funding strategies as the Commonwealth Transportation Board has allocated funds to date towards these corridor projects. And again, our key public benefits are also identified by the eight quarter bases and by those project outputs that we feel what we'll be bringing forward in the future. So how we roll into this? I think the biggest takeaway that you're going to see here today on this slide is that for the very first time, the Commonwealth Transportation Board will be considering a recommendation brought forward by the Director of the Department of Rail and Public Transportation to actually initiate intercity passenger rail service brought about in response to Amtrak's proposal that we briefed the board on at the Lynchburg meeting earlier this year. We will bring forward a three-year passenger rail operating demonstration project to initiate one intercity round-trip passenger train on a seven-day week schedule out of Richmond, Virginia, Staples Mill Station, to Washington, D.C., and points north into the Northeast Corridor, as well as the Lynchburg operation as well, to initiate one daily passenger train 7 days a week for the Lynchburg to Charlottesville and on up through Manassas in Washington, D.C., and into the Northeast Corridor. Of that perspective, we're looking forward to bring to this board a strategic six-year program allocation recommendation that deals with and utilizes existing resources and also brings forward a demonstration project that will help us initiate additional enhanced Amtrak passenger service on strategic corridors in Virginia, as well as also work within the confines of the available revenues that we see as we move forward. The last slide I'd like to leave with you today is a good takeaway slide. This is a graphic depiction of the change that we have seen recently in the project development process that we have with our funding partners. That's the Class 1 railroads and Amtrak and our commuter rail operator, Virginia Rail Express. When I stood before you back in 2005 with Karen Ray, we brought forward a strategy that showed mostly freight projects. As you'll see today, that we're trying to, again, move forward to how we make the best use of state investments, and you'll see that the projects we're bringing forward, we anticipate about a 67% combined passenger and freight benefit for projects as we move forward to bring to this board. This is a very encouraging statewide planning initiative that we feel that we're going to be very pleased to bring forth to you our proposal and update, which we'll probably bring back to the Secretary at sometime December or January timeframe, very similar to the process that VDOT outlined earlier today. I'd like to turn the floor back over to you, Mr. Chairman, members of the board, for your questions at this time.
Questions of Mr. Page. very important to look at that last slide, which is a list of projects to be incorporated into the six-year program. That's how you make these decisions. But there are some very significant steps forward with some potentially new passenger rail service between Lynchburg and Richmond up to D.C. I believe included in that is the completion of the I-81 diversion program. Was about half funded last time. Is that correct? And that's essentially the trackage between Manassas and Front Royal. Or actually, I guess all the way up to Hagerstown.
That's phase one, sir.
As well as some additional freight and Amtrak related improvements in the I-95 corridor. So this is one of the few, very few bright spots in transportation are these investments. Ms. Conner.
Are these numbers, the 481, I mean, these are unlike some of the highway dollars we're dealing with that are uncertain because the federal contribution and so on. These are more solid numbers?
More solid.
Okay. I.
And a big component of this is the capital bonds.
And private, right, and public and private contributions that support the match. That's required. And I think the key issue that we have to focus on is that with the Rail Enhancement Fund, everything is really based upon partnerships and sharing of cost and benefits. The slide that Kevin showed that about 67% of the projects had a combined freight and passenger benefit tells a big story. It says that Virginia can benefit with investment that provides support for increased passenger and freight at the same time. And we can leverage that money and get private money to help fund that project. And that's the key. And so when we come back to you, our intent is to have all of the agreements substantively executed so that, Ms. Connolly, we can in fact say that's a commitment relative to the capital cost of the project.
Mr. Chairman, I think Matt and his department ought to be commended for the leadership they have shown here. And obviously, from the standpoint of my district, I'm very pleased to see the Lynchburg to Washington train included. But beyond that, I think the board, the last slide that Kevin mentioned, the takeaway message, the board has been trying to really jumpstart passenger rail for a long time around the state. And to see that this program is more than two-thirds beneficial to both passenger rail and freight rail, I think is a sea change. And I think Matt and his staff should be commended for that.
Thank you.
Mr. Chairman, one additional suggestion from my colleagues is while the combination of public funds and private funds is substantial, $700 million plus, it's still a small fraction of that $4.7 billion that you're talking about for us to actually get the entire system's benefit that we're aiming for. So 15% of something is something, but we're going to have to be very attentive to this in the years ahead and continue to give it a priority over the, if it's really going to happen over the next 25 years, the way we want.
Quick comment, Mr. Chairman. 3 years ago, I think, at this meeting, former Governor Holton was here to plead for DRPT and the CTB to get cracking on passenger rail. And so here we are 3 years later, and it's a whole different ball game, as it were. So I think we ought to recognize that and give credit where credit is due to DRPT and keep this train on track and moving ahead.
It does start at the top, Mr. McCarthy. the other thing I think that's important to note is these are very, very difficult negotiations. And so while certainly the policy direction from this body and the governor is there, and Mr. Tucker and Mr. Page are working 24/7 to do this, it does require the agreement of either Norfolk Southern and CSX for the freight improvements. In the case of passenger rail, it's the private railroad plus Amtrak. And in some cases, the agreement of VRE, because there is finite capacity on the tracks, and that has to be apportioned among freight rail, intercity rail, and commuter rail. And it is not unlimited capacity. So hopefully when we get to an agreement, and let's knock on wood that that occurs, I think it would be very instructive, Matt and Kevin, to describe some of the things, the limitations of that capacity and the give and take that it takes to get this blend of 67% freight and passenger. And that's a very, very delicate and challenging balance. And it's like trying to thread a needle on the deck of an aircraft carrier in the middle of a storm in the middle of the night. So good luck, gentlemen.
Thank you.
Mr. Page also has the next item, which is state safety and security oversight. And I would, by way of introduction, this has been discussed previously, but this is a major new responsibility of the Commonwealth. This is a very important report, and I hope everyone pays very, very close attention to this.
Hey, thank you, Mr. Chairman, members of the board, and thank you for that introductory remark. State safety oversight as Chief of Rail of Virginia, I have to say this is one of my most important roles. This is the equivalent. I want to just kind of give you a takeaway. We've heard of the Federal Railroad Administration in having the safety oversight of how railroads operate. Well, this is the equivalent of that. Rail fixed guideway transit systems are light rail lines, and very similarly, we have the Metro Rail operation in Northern Virginia that comes into Northern Virginia, part of Washington, D.C. and Maryland as well as the Tide operation, which is under construction for those of you who have been following that newspaper down in the Norfolk area. The federal regulations, Federal Transit Authority regulations, FTA regulations, require that states set up a rail transit system to designate a state safety oversight agency. And of that authority, DRPT, through its powers granted to us, as well as those handed down through the Commonwealth Transportation Board as well, is that we at DRPT have been designated by the governor in 1996, a letter to FTA, to actually be the designated state safety oversight agency for the Commonwealth of Virginia. And also a carry forward of that, I've been involved in this process now for almost 2 years, in looking at other systems operated throughout the other states of the United States, we have two dedicated full-time positions that we have that are dealing specifically in the Safety and Security Administration of this program. That's probably a significant increase over what some of the other states are doing as well. So we do take this very, very seriously, and you'll see why in the presentation as it unfolds in just a minute. Our annual cost at DRPT are about $400,000 that include the payments for the WMATA program, and I'll speak a little bit more specifically to the WMATA program in a minute. And as Mr. Chairman, Mr. Keene, Member Keene mentioned earlier about dusting out the corners, $200,000 was set out by this board in April of 2007, and I want to thank you all for it. It's been very, very helpful in assisting us in setting up the new program standard for the Norfolk Light Rail Line project. Without that money, we would not be as far along as we are today in setting up that program. We also have an administrative budget that we will need to accommodate and also serve through as we continue on an annual basis to operate this program. We represent, as I mentioned earlier, WMATA, Washington Metropolitan Area Transit Authority, operates the Metro Rail Line. In 1997, the Tri-State Oversight Committee Memorandum of Understanding was executed between the three entities that actually WMATA serves, Washington, D.C., Maryland, and Virginia. Of that, we have the Tri-State Oversight Committee that's called TOC, that we represent 30% of. That means that every single incident or any other oversight of safety under the federal program that occurs, the Commonwealth of Virginia through DRPT is involved in the oversight of the safety assurance of that agency. As well, we, as I mentioned earlier, the Norfolk Tide Project, Hampton Roads Transit's new system, light rail system that's underway, under construction. We are also developing today the program standard to move forward with the state safety oversight implementation of that line as well. So what are the requirements? What is DRPT's responsibility? Our responsibility, which is a very serious one that we are taking, is we need to also set up, as a process with this for the time, is that we need to approve, track, and monitor the system safety, the system security, the audits of how the tracks and the operations are maintained, both at the local level as the operator and also us, the State Safety Oversight Agency. We have an obligation to that as well, to make sure that any hazards that we find under our triennial review or annual review process that or following an accident or incident that a corrective action plan or a hazard elimination plan is set forth and put in place. And we also have to make sure that the transit operator is also inspecting and assuring themselves that the operation of the line is safe, the operators of the vehicles meet all of the qualifications, classifications, and also the maintenance of the vehicles and the track is maintained. This also gets involved in the design and the construction of the project as well. State oversight agencies, we are literally notified within 2 hours of all accidents or incidents. That goes for WMATA, and also what we will have is when the tide is up and running. We also have to work through as I mentioned earlier, about a triennial audit process, investigation of accidents and how they fall into the annual audit as to how they were retired under a corrective action plan. We also are responsible to the Federal Transit Administration, not only for our federal requirements, we're also assuring that the local transit agency as well is upholding and abiding by the certification of the program as it's set out in the federal code. We also don't identify and evaluate findings for the National Transportation Safety Board. If an accident is at a certain threshold level, the NTSB gets involved, and also we have to work forward with a cooperative agreement with them as well. The light rail line, as I mentioned, down at the Tide, we must prepare and implement. This is where the $200,000 comes into play that the board allocated in April, in 07. We have to also work through the program standard, the system safety plan, internal safety security program, hazardous management process. Security and emergency is also a part of this. Being the Tide, no pun intended, is a coastal located area. We also have to also look at some of their emergency preparedness plans as well as we move forward with that. Well, let's talk a little bit about liability. Obviously, with federal regulations of this type of classification, there's also some exposure and responsibilities of the Commonwealth as well. We're the state safety oversight. We must comply fully with the FTA regulations. I'm going to give you just an example in just a minute about how the NTSB got involved in an incident or accident out in Chicago. But we also can find that the NTSB, if we're not upholding the safety and security and assuring that these programs are in place, we can also be a causal factor for an accident or incident that can occur at that light rail line operation. Also, the NTSB can issue recommendations to all identified parties. That would be the Federal Transit Administration, the Commonwealth of Virginia, and in this case, the light rail operator. The example I'd like to put forward to you today, just to kind of express in its own right the importance of this program and the implications if it's not implemented properly. Out at the Chicago Transit Authority, there was a major accident that occurred in July of 2006. You can kind of run through the slide. I know we're pushed for time. But it was an incident that required the Chicago Transit Authority to notify. The NTSB became involved in that. And also, the local regional transit authority, the RTA, Chicago Transit Authority, actually had oversight of some several lines as well, which we'll talk about that. They're the equivalent of DRPT, by the way, in this instance. The NTSB came in. They did their investigation. They found that the state oversight agency was also a party to the investigations. They looked at the oversight, the regulatory control, if hazards were identified, were they eliminated, were the corrective action plans, and they also looked at the system safety program. What the NTSB rolled out was the Chicago Transit Authority was not maintaining their tracks, or the oversight of the track inspection also was not upheld. So they were found deficient in those areas. The contributing factors to that was also the state safety oversight agency, that appropriate actions had not been taken by the oversight agency. In this case, it could have been DRPT. And also, the FTA also found that there was an obligation of the FTA, the local regional transit authority, as well as the state oversight agency. Now, of course, this is the implication as it cascades out, Mr. Chairman and members of the board, is that there was a failed role in state safety oversight. And through that failure of safety oversight at all levels, not only, again, was the Federal Transit Administration, but the local state oversight agency and the local transit operator for the light rail operation and subway operation, was all found potentially contributing factors to this accident. So again, that leads us forward to how we need to make sure that we set this program up appropriately and we administer it within the greatest possible care and concern, not only for the people that will be riding these trains and be operating around them, but also for the fact that there is exposure to the Commonwealth of Virginia for this responsibility. What our next steps are is we have one vacancy in Northern Virginia right now under TOC. We will fill that position. We're in the process now working through human resources on that. As well as I mentioned earlier, through the $200,000 that was allocated by the board, we have developed a program standard. We will continue to finalize that and then get it to FTA for review and approval of that standard. As part of the implementation of the program, Hampton Roads Transit will have to review and adopt our program standard so that they can develop theirs as well as their emergency preparedness plan. And also we'll probably have some public comment opportunity on that new regulatory process as well. Mr. Chairman, members of the board, I'll be happy to turn the floor back over to you all for any questions at this time. Thank you.
Questions of Mr. Page? Ms. Connors.
I'm just interested. This is so vitally important. What big sticks do we have to assure compliance? I mean, we have the oversight. How do we achieve the needed changes? Are they fines or costs or what?
There are two different mechanisms that we can use, Mr. Chair and members of the board. Thank you, Ms. Conley, for your question. The first one is that we have a corrective action plan process where we can go in and actually require, through our oversight authority, go in and require that the hazard be eliminated or there be some type of continuing action plan as to how we go about retiring, removing that safety hazard out of the way. If it's not eliminated, through the federal code, there are opportunities to actually go to a level of actually putting their own federal funding in jeopardy as well as a part of that. In addition to that, through the powers of the administration of the agency, the Department of Rail and Public Transportation, we can also work to assure that safety, and also we are a funding agency as well. Now, Mr. Tucker has some other ideas he may have in mind as well he may want to comment on, but I think that we will have the ability to go in and deal and address with those safety issues as they come up. And also, I certainly feel in both working with TOC up at Wamana and also with HRT in issues that may have come up or will come up over time, we have good working relationships with those agencies to move forward in alleviating those situations.
But I think, Kevin, the big answer is from a state point of view, we can stop and we will stop funding. State funding to a grantee that wants to operate in an unsafe manner. The other key piece of what we're looking to do is as we make that determination that they're in non-compliance, that we will have to file a report, essentially something related to unsafe working conditions, which automatically will require an investigation from another state agency to resolve it. I think we're in a unique position. I worked in California, and the California PUC was much stronger regulatory authority, but they really didn't have the funding mechanism to close it down. And I think the key piece about this program is about saving lives. And I'll tell, quite frankly, in my previous life, I've gone to accidents where light rail systems and heavy rail systems where there have been multiple fatalities. And one note that Kevin didn't mention on that Chicago slide, that there were more than 100 and something folks hurt as a matter of that accident. So this is not a program that we should take lightly. The key fact is once we set up a program standard, it essentially will obligate all future transit systems that are built in the Commonwealth of Virginia to meet that standard. And I know some of you probably have seen some of the discussions related in the Virginia Beach region about, a review. And it's really, from our perspective, not about necessarily a federal project as it's defined through New Starts, but it's about the future implementation and how we can ensure safety. And this is something I would tell you over time, we have to get better as an agency. We have to gain greater technical experience to make sure that we have folks that can deal with these kinds of issues and do these investigations. These are very hard positions to identify and track people and retain people. And we've gone through, with your help over the last few years, of trying to strengthen our expertise. But the key piece on that slide was there's a vacancy, and that vacancy is the vacancy that supports WMATA. And we absolutely have to make sure we get someone that is very understanding of the importance of state safety oversight.
Ms. Kuhlman.
Mr. Chairman, Kevin, didn't you just issue a new set of recommendations to the TIDE?
Yes, there was a...
could you just outline those very quickly, sir?
There was a recommendation report. Sure, there was under that evaluation, there were seven recommendations that came out. Some were just simple enhancements to safety, not necessarily... the TIDE is not an unsafe operations design. There are enhancements to that. There were grade crossing lights and gates, for example. PA systems at the station facilities themselves. That also helps for emergency preparedness, as well as putting in crossovers and pocket tracks at stations so that the trains could cross from one track to another. In addition, that was installing duct banks, for example, so that fiber optics and other communication lines could follow through there as well. And then also, in keeping with that, there are a few sections of line that will actually go up to 55 miles an hour. So as you all remember, the Transportation Board back in September, we had automatic train control cast signalization that was one of the projects that was acted on up in Winchester. Very similar to that, the 55-mile-an-hour traffic, we're trying to put in automatic train signals as well. So that right now, that system, although it can operate line of sight, we want to put signals up. So when you get trains running at that speed, those light rail trains, that we will have a safer operation. In over and above the line of sight operation, which was already considered a safe operation, but it can certainly be enhanced for safer operations at that speed. Then at the follow at the end of that, that totaled about $7 million, Mr. Coulomb, of improvements that we felt were identified and needed to be made. We also put in what we called an operation transitional plan as well, needed to put together as to how we start up the system. You train operators, burn in the rail cars, and get that system up and running. So that was the result of that document as well. And Mr. Tucker might want to add a little bit to that, but I think from general purposes, that's just an overview of where we were on that.
Yeah, I think this is the key, what Kevin said. The system is, as it's designed, is absolutely a safe system. And what we were looking at is how do we enhance the system, especially, if you envision future extensions. The duct bank was probably one of the key item that we identified, because the key is the duct bank is where all of the fiber optics and communication systems would be. If you didn't build it now and you did a future extension to Virginia Beach, you would have to go up and open up that track section again. And that's a pretty hard thing for people to see, that you just built the rail line and then you open it up again to install a duct bank. And that was probably the key piece for us, is making sure that was in the project, as well as the automatic block signal. All of us recall, the Metrolink accident that happened a few months ago in terms of trains sharing track and running into each other. One of our concerns was obviously that as you make that system, you extend that system out, you're operating 55 miles per hour, you want to make sure that there's a means and methods of controlling access so you don't have trains even running up behind each other or colliding.
Mr. Chairman, certainly safety is, I recognize, one of the most important functions, Kevin, and it appears to me that our focus has been primarily, and our discussion is centered around unsafe conditions, and I know that's an area that we can look at. But if we look at some of these major accidents that we're seeing on rail, they're unsafe practices. And right. And my question really leads to, do we have some carrot, as Judy's talked about compliance with the Drug-Free Workplace Act and things like that, as an additional part of the safety program that could enhance their performance in that area considerably, because...
Right, Mr. Chairman. Thank you, Mr. King, for your comment. Under the State Safety Oversight Program, there are 21 key elements under the safety portion. Part of that is drug testing and operator training. So we, the Commonwealth of Virginia, will have to fall behind HRT to make sure that they're following the federal law for the Drug-Free Workplace Act. And there's also a rigorous drug testing regulatory program that FDA also requires, as well. It includes post-accident random sampling and also pre-employment. So it's a very strong and supportive process, both by federal law and also through requirements of the regulations. I think Mr. Tucker would also...
I think the key answer is this, Mr. King. HRT, once that system is built, they have to get a certificate from us to operate. And we have to approve their regulations, their training program, and they have to demonstrate that they have a program in place that's safe. We would not grant them a certificate to operate until they have clearly demonstrated to us that it is safe operations.
One final observation.
Final word.
Final observation. I am. This is weighing on me more than just what we're talking about at the moment, but the bottom of slide 12, that failed role of oversight. That, in other words, the failure of safety oversight at all levels rather than a failure to adequately fund maintenance. I just increasingly see us as an overall oversight body. We're going to be facing exactly this question. I'm not feeling very comfortable about it at the moment, quite frankly. And the adequately funded is a part of our challenge, and it's a part that we have difficulty getting at. So I'd like to ask my colleagues to think a little bit with us, with all of us, about what we should do, because it can be our failure, regardless of who else's failure it may be. And the modern business theory of multiple mistakes is what actually leads to these types of things. So.
Okay, thank you very much. Thank you, Ms. Page. A very sobering presentation. It's about 4:45. We have two more presentations to go. Let me poll the board. We can. We do have Dr. Allen here today, so I think we do need to hear from him. Would you like to take a short break and come back to that? We do have a reception at 6:30, which is a bit of a walk or a car ride for some, and we can't be late for that that important reception. So you want to keep going or take a break?
Break. You're not getting.
We're not hearing consensus. Then we're going to go ahead. All right. Those who need to take a break may do so at their convenience. The next two items are very important studies that were mandated by the General Assembly. You all know Gary Allen, head of the Research Council, and chief of technology at VDOT. The first has very, very significant funding allocation issues. And Dr. Allen is going to give you a vanilla presentation, but I will tell you the impetus behind this was to see if there was some way to administratively change the highway funding allocation formula. So if you have an interest in that, you may want to pay close attention to this presentation. Welcome, Dr. Allen, and sorry to have made you wait so long.
That's all right. Thank you, Mr. Secretary. I do understand it's been a long day for all of you. I'm going to move through this, and then if you have questions, I would certainly be happy to answer them. I do have the scientist here, Matt Grimes, who did the primary work for this, so he can talk to you about the details if you would like. I'm happy to have Matt with us. Just running very quickly through this, I'm going to talk a little bit about the mandate, some about the background. We're going to talk about challenges that were involved in addressing this mandate from the General Assembly. We'll talk a little bit about one way of approaching this, some implications, and then a few concluding remarks. The mandate itself calls for the department to develop a plan to reassign roads to the primary, the secondary, and the urban systems using functional classification to every extent practicable, and then to analyze the implications of the plan both from a programmatic standpoint and perhaps some of the other aspects of it, present a plan to the Commonwealth Transportation Board for advice and consent, and then present a plan to the Governor and the General Assembly before January 1 of 2009. This mandate came out of the, I think, the seventh enactment clause of the Acts of Assembly of 2007. And as the Secretary has mentioned, there was a desire to see certain effects regarding the allocation formula coming out of this. Let's just talk briefly about the overview of classification systems. I think you are well aware of most of this, but it often is instructive to go back in history and look at how we got to where we are with the administrative classification. It emerged between 1918 and today, one route at a time, one route at a time. You can actually go back in history and you can see in the code of Virginia that there were actually segments of primary roadways that were designated to go through certain cities. That was in the code. The administrative classification system is continuous for the primary, the secondary, and the urban system. In other words, it does not have breaks in it. It is based on routes or corridors, And it is absolutely not functionally defined and never was intended to be. Functional classification, actually the 1968 National Highway Functional Classification Study Manual was first used to classify roads in 1968, but it was not until 1973 that the Federal Aid Highway Act required that states functionally classify roads in order to receive federal funding. It's a documented method. It's approved by FHWA. It allows for a lot of latitude, but it also has a lot of rules. It's based on roadway segments, not corridors, not routes. Segments. In other words, you can have a segment of a primary road that is functionally classified as an arterial, and a segment of a primary road functionally classified as a collector. And therein lies the difficulty of trying to address Chapter 896. I show here on this slide a schematic of functional classification. It doesn't show all of the classification scheme. There are actually 22 categories. There are 18, I think, that are shown here, but there are truly 22. As we move on, there was no stated policy goal in the Chapter 896 mandate. No stated policy goal. So what that meant is we had to look at a lot of different alternatives, and we made an assumption to try to develop a low-impact alternative. In other words, to try to preserve things as much as we could and still meet the mandate. The plan that I'm going to talk about maintains city responsibility for roads within municipal boundaries, and our thought process there was that that was consistent with the First Cities Initiative and a lot of other things that provide for an urban environment. The plan is based on similarities between the federal criteria and the most logical apparent function. I emphasize the word apparent between primary, secondary, and urban systems. Principal arterials are most like the primary, but not always. Collectors and locals are most like the secondary, but not always. And so when you run into those rules, you run into difficulties. Now, we actually came up with a candidate plan, and this, again, was what we thought was a low-impact plan. What it really shows here is that principal arterials in the counties go into the primary system. Minor arterials that are rural within counties go into the primary. Principal arterials in cities and towns go into the urban system. Minor arterials in cities and towns go into the urban system. So this is just a schematic of what the plan itself might look like. But when you look at the impacts get very significant, even though we attempted to choose a low-impact plan. Primary lane mileage currently is about 8,080 miles. What you end up with is 5,480 miles. That's a reduction of 2,600 centerline miles on the primary system. Secondary system goes up. Urban system stays about the same. Let's look at the implications for primary allocations, and I'm sure some of you might want to look at this.
Dr. Davis has arrived just in time.
Just in time, Dr. Davis. Welcome.
Thanks.
What we've attempted to do here is to recognize that the inputs to the allocation formula for the primary system are lane miles and DMT. And if we look at these inputs, what we see is the current percent of input. You can just take Bristol, for example, is 8.7. But under the 896 plan, the low-impact plan, there's an 18.4% reduction likely to occur in the allocation to the Bristol district. And I'm sure Mr. Keene is looking at me with dagger eyes. And
So is Mr.
Billy. I can understand
He's picked it up.
I can understand that. But you can scale down through this pretty quickly and see where the gains and where the losses are. And they are significant. They are significant.
If,
Mr. Secretary.
If I could just, you know, focus on this again. This was when this legislation came up, we essentially said, why are you delegating this to an administrative entity? And, you know, the intent was very clear. And so please understand why Dr. Allen is doing this. But there's a second aspect of this I think you can figure out, and two-second aspect. The first is Dr. Allen saying this is the low-impact alternative. There are other ways of constructing this that are far more profound in terms of the redistribution of the funds, number one. And number two, you know, one of the things you would say, well, gosh, I may be losing on primary, but would I be making it up on secondary? And the answer to that is no. Secondary road funds are not allocated on the basis of mileage. It's population and land area. So those counties that had roads come out of the primary system or the equivalent of the primary system and go into the equivalent of the secondary system, there would be all that added need on essentially the existing secondary resources.
Ms. Conrad. Maybe everyone else understands this, but what is the definition or what is the determining factors in functionality? Is it just volume or what are the host of factors that
I'm gonna ask Matt Grimes to
Well maybe that's getting into the weeds, but I don't know.
Matt, give the top three or four or five. Come on up here, please.
The Federal Highway Administration has got a document, it's fairly old, it's about 20 years old, that goes into the details of how to determine what the functional classification of the road is. And there's a lot of factors. And so some of them include whether or not a road serves urban centers, the continuity of the system, land use considerations, spacing between routes, and that's where one of the rules comes into play. You can't have two roads that are, say, principal arterials that are close together, even if they're both important. You can't have them close together.
Who says?
They won't approve it. They also stipulate that a certain percentage of your mileage should be in less than such classification. And it's my understanding that our staff, if they exceed that, they have to enter into protracted, difficult discussions with them to get it approved. Average trip length is another consideration. The traffic volumes, the control of access, and the vehicle miles traveled. Those are different factors that are balanced to determine whether a road should be a principal arterial, a minor arterial, a collector, and so forth. Now, there is no stipulation from the Federal Highway Administration on how to balance those. They don't say this criterion is the most important. But in the end, everything has to wash out according to this such, thus and such a percentage of the road should be in this functional classification. Our staff in the planning division go through this process of designating federal functional classification roads after every census, or based on data from every census. So every 10 years it's updated. And then they get it approved by the Federal Highway Administration. Does that answer your question, ma'am?
He's given me a lot of information. I'm not sure I have processed it yet.
It's one of those, there's a 640-page manual to determine which is and which is not, and at the end of the day, it's somebody else who makes that final determination if it is or is not a principal arterial, I think is the simple answer.
And we are more or less required now to...
Oh, yes, and have been for 30 years.
Yes. We have no choice but to...
But you said up until recently we've been identifying them by routes or by cars.
Now that's the administrative classification. What we're required to do in Chapter 896 is try to crosswalk as much as possible from functional class to administrative class. And what I'm getting to is there's no rational, logical, reasonable approach to this.
Okay, let's see if we can get through this presentation and then take questions if we may. Okay.
Very good. Let me just give you an example. You end up with huge gaps in the primary system, for example, if you follow this sort of approach. This is the Haymarket area, primary system. You can see the counties. You know there is a lot of economic activity going on. The dotted circles show gaps in the primary system that result from following functional class and trying to crosswalk into administrative class. It's just unreasonable. It doesn't make any sense when you look at Route 15, Route 28, Route 29. Makes no sense. Let's go a little further. There is a possible alternative that we've been having some discussions about at the department that could connect the Commonwealth without regard for previous mandates or functional class or administrative class. And what we've been talking about doing is basing such a system, an alternative approach, on connecting important locations such as towns, county seats, hospitals, fire and rescue, distribution, intermodal centers, planned locations, ensuring continuity between and through localities without being constrained by jurisdictional boundaries, ensuring redundancy for the system for safety purposes such as Route 1 and I-95, Route 11 and I-81, and so on. We began the work on this system back early in the spring at the request of the commissioner. The Research Council, Central Office Planning staff, people from Central Office System Operations staff, and district planners got together and began to work on how we might craft a system that had some logic to it and result in a seamless statewide network of what we called significant roads. It incorporates all functional classes. It would likely require some administrative class changes. It addresses 85% of the activity on the entire state system. And by that I mean it accounts for 85% of the freight movement, at least perhaps more, VMT, very high volume roads, even where most crashes and safety impacts are. It's approximately 20,000 centerline miles as we've worked on it to date, as compared to about 57,000 centerline miles. It supports access management and land use and transportation linkages in a logical fashion. But yet, it certainly would need to be scrutinized, examined, discussed. If you look at the Haymarket area and a network of significant roads, you can see the difference between the network of significant roads for the Haymarket area under this kind of approach and the approach for the primary system if you use functional class. You get a much more robust system of connectivity. And that would be true across the state. We just offer a few concluding remarks. Chapter 896 does not result, no matter what you do, at least all the alternatives we've looked at, doesn't result in a logical, seamless network. Segments of less significant roads become, quote-unquote, significant. And segments of significant roads will be placed in the secondary system. There's no way to comply with Chapter 896 while retaining a seamless network of significant roads. There's no reasonable plan based on functional classification that can be used to assign roads to administrative class. I'm going to just offer an opportunity that the Commonwealth Transportation Board might want to have more workshops around alternatives for the future. Certainly that would be at your pleasure, Mr. Secretary and members of the board. Thank you.
I know there will be questions. One of the other interesting aspects of this study resolution is that it requires the commissioner to make a recommendation with the advice and consent of the Commonwealth Transportation Board on this matter. So the thing that you're hearing from the research is that what the commissioner has been asked to make a recommendation essentially up or down on from the perspective of the commissioner in VDOT does not work. It is not a continuous system. What Dr. Allen and the commissioner are suggesting as well, if you're looking for something that is, you know, the most important set of highway connections, there may be an alternative way of doing it, and that's what Dr. Allen is talking about, of roughly the 20,000 most important miles in the state. And there's obviously not a lot of descriptives there. But the first task and the responsibility of the CTB is to pass judgment on the functional classification. That we have been given a statutory charge, and that will come back to you at our next meeting. It has to occur before the first of the year. Whether or not VDOT and the commissioner want to continue to explore this idea, whether or not CTB wants to ask that that idea continue to be formed, that in some respects is a separate question, but it also may be a way of gently steering the General Assembly into an area that is not quite so divisive, but does, you know, offer some guidance as to determining in this era of shrinking resources what are the most important assets in the system. But as we all know, when you change that in something of that magnitude, there are winners and there are losers. And I don't believe there's enough data to make that determination on any of these more sophisticated and continuous plans. I do think there's enough analysis to say you don't have a continuous system with the functional classification, which is what the General Assembly has asked us to provide our advice and consent on. And we will have a recommendation from the commissioner at the next meeting. So, questions? Mr. Bowie.
Chairman, you say that it requires the advice and consent of this board. Pretty complex situation. It would have been awfully nice if we could have gotten this 2 or 3 months ago instead of getting it in mid-November when we're required to provide the report to the governor and the General Assembly in January 1. This had a tremendous if I understand, and I'm not sure that I do, but if I understand the consequences of this, it has a tremendous impact on the district from which I come, the district Dr. Davis comes from, James Keene. I'd like to know a whole lot more about this than I know now before any input on my vote for it. Mm-hmm.
Mr. Bowie, I think your advice and consent is pretty clear cut. Just looking at slide number 9 here. But in all seriousness, I think the answer to the upfront question that the General Assembly has asked of us is pretty simple and straightforward. I think it's what are the next step that is more complicated. But I would say that Dr. Allen and his staff stand ready to address any questions that any members of the board have, whether it's via email, telephone, or whatever.
Mr. Secretary, in our work, we certainly are not recommending such a plan as the 896 response. We are not recommending that.
And I think it's safe to assume, nor is the commissioner.
Yes, sir.
Mr. Chairman, there are a couple of questions maybe you can help me with. As I studied that, I tried to understand, is 896 the requirements new, or has it been dramatically changed that caused us to have to go through this process?
The Enactment Clause 7 in the 2007 Acts of Assembly is what required us to do this, nothing other than that.
In the state, from the Commonwealth?
Yes, sir.
And the second question is the reclassification automatically tied to a funding formula, or are both independent decisions that need to be made? Because there is no way that I can see possible any friendly way to deal with this, to cut the rural areas of Virginia by this significant amount. In other words, everything from Bristol to Salem to Winchester, you're going to take away 20% of the funding because of a classification conversation. That's not acceptable. And I don't think you'll find the legislators in those districts that to have that be acceptable either. Because what you're doing, in effect, if you do that, you're taking an old funding formula that was based on a different way of thinking, applying a new set of rules and saying that you can apply that financial standard. And I don't think that's acceptable.
I couldn't agree with you more.
Mr. Chairman.
Ms. Coolman.
Mr. Chairman, I agree a lot with my colleagues. The fact is that this classification mismatch with a resource allocation formula is a straitjacket that binds all of us. It's not just one region or one district. It keeps us from being able to respond to changes that are occurring in every part of the Commonwealth. It forces us to respond. It's like this is the only tool you have, and this is so just write something. That's all you can do. And I do think that we can play a very positive role in helping create a different set of politics that surround this discussion. For example, a large part of both these systems, the funding allocation and the classification system, grew up kind of willy-nilly. It's been kind of codified as we've gone along, but nobody would have invented it from the beginning. So our ability now, with specifically new technology tools, to understand what population trends are, data on vehicle miles traveled, the connectivity that you spoke about, we can not only know those things, we can visualize them, we can show them, we can map them. It's not a question of it's Route 15 and you just have to make Route 15 do one thing. So I think we have the tools to be able to get to the level of detail we need to understand. And in fact, I would expect that most parts of the Commonwealth would benefit from the connectivity, whether or not the total number was the same or not. The connectivity is actually what we're talking about. In fact, we're discovering that that miles that aren't as useful as other miles are a net drag on our system. So I would say that if we can help put aside some of our natural district tendencies, like I need more, you need less, the pie's only this big, so anything you get comes out of my money, we might be able to restructure this whole discussion. And I think that's one thing you said, is there's not a simple administrative, write the law a different way that's going to solve these problems. So I'd like to approach this in a very positive way. And have us use your resources, our technology resources, our good sense about the way the system has to work, and let's see if we can recast this whole discussion so that you're not a loser, I'm not a loser, nobody's a loser, everybody's a gainer.
Mr. Chairman,
as I understand it, now next month we will be asked basically to look at a resolution that will probably mirror bullet 2 in the conclusion remarks, that there's no way to comply with Chapter 896. And then we would also have some type of suggestion that we could look at or that we could address on a different basis. But the resolution would say, we just can't do this. And I'm ready to endorse that. So if that's all the action we're going to have next month, then we got time to work on this other thing.
Yeah, that's in a nutshell, that's correct. Okay. All right, any other questions?
Mr. Chairman, I agree with Mr. Keene, except that I would specify that we don't think this will work at all from any standpoint, and that direct the CTB to come up with an alternative and it's by December 1st of next year.
Yeah. Well, and I think that's the easy part. The question is, do we as a body want to devote some time to thinking about this? And I think there's some merit to thinking through the issues. The commissioner's clearly been thinking about this for a while, probably not quite ready for prime time and discussion, but I think we ought to give them an opportunity to present that. Okay.
Mr. Chairman, I think we should look at something like that, because in this new reality where we find ourselves with no money and the prospect of less money, then we can't move. We've got a lot of projects on the books and none of them can be built. And I don't know whether 20,000 miles is the right number to look at, but we've certainly got to take another look at our priorities. And I'm not sure we can get it done by December 1st, but I would support that concept of the board taking a look at it and seeing what we can come up with to recommend to the General Assembly.
Okay. We have one. Excuse me. I'm sorry. Ms. Dickens.
The difficulty in all this process, and I'm not sure I understand what generated this chapter, but the difficulty in this process is that there's a perception that the more congested areas need more money and the rural areas need less money. And the only way you fix that is moving money around, and you have winners and losers. And I'm interested to look at these winners and losers here. It appears that the winners are the more populated areas, with the exception of Hampton Roads, and I don't quite understand why that wouldn't fit in that category.
Here it is.
But I think if we're going to look at changing this formula allocation, which may be good, may be bad, but you got to have a situation where you have no losers in the process. And I think there was a couple of JLARC studies that have addressed that very issue. And the conclusion was that you would have winners and losers, and that you can't get something like that through the General Assembly. So this all boils back to the issue of new money. And the only way this is going to get really addressed is if there's new money, so that there are not winners and losers. So how do we get to that point?
Well, we've been trying that for 3 years. Who knows? We may have that opportunity again.
More than three, sir.
Moving right along. The next and final presentation on tonight's agenda is also by Dr. Allen. This is on an overload and overweight vehicle study, also conducted by the Research Council, again mandated by the General Assembly, House Bill 1551.
Yes, sir. I'm going to move through this one very quickly as well. This mandate, House Bill 1551, calls for a review of the current fee structure for overload and overweight vehicles. It was to be conducted by VDOT in consultation with DMV, and also to get input and reactions from industry representatives to determine what fees, if any, additional fees should be associated with damage and additional maintenance costs caused by overweight and overload vehicles. And then the commissioner is to recommend legislation regarding a fee structure by December 1, 2008. It doesn't say that he shall recommend increases in fees or decreases in fees. Just says recommend legislation. Let's just take a quick look at the permit situation. Let me call to your attention the total for column two, number issued. That number should be 93,139. That's not 93,099, but it's pretty close. What this shows is that in 2008, DMV issued about 93,000 overweight permits. That means overweight or overload, as compared to the Code of Virginia. Just as an example, it means that it might have issued a permit for a tractor trailer for more than 80,000 pounds. You can see single trip permits, they make up the vast majority. Most of them are relatively short trips, less than 500 miles. Blanket permits, that means that you don't have to indicate how many miles, and you don't have to say where you're going. You can see the fee structure there. You'll notice tank wagons. Tank wagons were the subject of a study that was mandated by the General Assembly previously. For 1 year, they paid $800 as a flat fee. As a result of the work that we did, their fee has been established at $265 annually. Hydro excavators, you can see what the average fee is there. All of these permits for overload, overweight, overgross, overaxle vehicles are generating about $2.6 million each year. I'll go back to the Senate Bill 1321 work that we did year before last, as again called for by the General Assembly. We developed engineering models. For 50 years, we have known that weight matters. It matters a lot. It is a power function. And I don't think we need to spend an awful lot of time going through that, other than I will say to you, there is a difference in the engineering principles as it applies to pavements as compared to bridges. Pavements are designed for what are called ESALs, E-S-A-L-S, equivalent single axle loads. That's 18,000 pounds on a single axle. Every pavement that we design in VDOT and every pavement we construct is designed to handle a certain number of ESALs before they have to be overlaid or replaced. So basically what you do with pavements is that you consume them. You consume them by repetitive ESALs. An automobile or a motorcycle represents 0.0002% of the number of ESALs that are contributed by an 80,000 pound tractor trailer. Okay? It's just something to think about.
In terms of 1,000?
Yeah. In terms of bridges, bridges operate on a different principle. It has to do with moments of inertia and movements of that bridge. Bridges are flexible, and so we design those bridges so they can handle multiple vehicles at a time with various spacings of axles and weights. And we have the chief engineer in the back of the room who can certainly speak to that issue. And I will yield to him at any time. Let's go to the next slide. Axle weight related pavement cost analysis. What we did in this study is the same thing we did in Senate Bill 1321. We used axle weights of all vehicles to determine cost per ESAL mile. We used actual Virginia data from weigh in motion sites all over the state to estimate actual weights of trucks when they travel. Sometimes they deadhead and they don't have anything on them. But the figures that we use represent actual weights. It counts for miles that trucks travel at less than full capacity. It charges only for axle weights above the standard weight limits. That's what this focus of this study is. But we can use it to estimate the added maintenance cost from a single overweight trip or from blanket permits. On the bridge side of the house, we went to the bridge division. We sat down with the folks in the bridge division. We worked with them to look at the bridge formula and how they actually issue permits to overweight and overloaded trucks. And we developed a methodology based on that. We found out that approximately 30,000 of the permits each year affect bridges. 30,000 out of the 93,000 affect bridges. What did we find out? Well, we can actually estimate permit fees for overweight vehicles. We can base it on sound engineering principles and relate it to axle weight, related to configuration, related to miles that are traveled. For pavements, the fee is about 3.56 cents per ESAL mile for weights above the standard legal limit. What that translates to, for an 80,000 pound truck, tractor trailer, loaded to capacity, when you consider how many ESALs they have, it's about 8 cents per truck mile. 8 cents per truck mile. Now, that does not account for what are called common costs. Common costs. And the reason for that is because weight-related damage is only about 19% of total costs. It's only about 19%. Let's see here. I may have gone through it. Nope. Okay, it's about 19% of total costs, and common costs represent about 80%. About 80%. So what we're focusing on is weight-related costs, and we don't add the common cost to it. Let's just take some examples. If we look at a sample fee of 116,000-pound six-axle tractor-trailer traveling I-81 northbound, it's a single permit, 325 miles and 58 bridges. The fee is $142, $143. Doesn't include any common costs. It's about $37 for the pavement fee. That boils down to about 11 cents a mile. And then it's $105 for the bridge fee. And I think that works out to be about 40 cents total per mile. Let's look at another example. Let's look at a blanket permit for a 100,000-pound six-axle tractor trailer, good for 12 months, traveling 50,000 miles. The pavement fee is going to be about $2,000. All right, now, that won't come out to be 8 cents a mile if you do the math. Why is that? It's because we tried to be practical in this. We made some assumptions that accounted for deadhead hauls, okay? We also for the bridge fee, we said, all right, let's see if we could, if we just assumed that as a policy matter, we wanted to generate $5 million each year from blanket permits, it'd be about $400 a pop. Okay. If we do some more analysis here, I've just provided a number of examples. We have developed a really easy-to-use calculator. We can do all kinds of scenarios. But what you'll see at the, if you go down through line 1, 2, 3, 4, line 1 through 4, those are actually blanket permits. You can see from the mileages. 50,000 miles, 50,000 miles, 10,000, and 10,000. We've shown five-axle trucks, five-axle, three-axle dump trucks, and a four-axle concrete truck. You can see what the potential fee structure is, currently what they pay, and what the potential could be. The bottom half of the chart are for single trips. You'll see that the permit fees currently for single trips, a seven-axle tractor trailer, $14. It would be $54 under the weight-related approach. One point I would like to make to you is the more axles you put under a load, the less the cost, because you reduce the single axle impacts on the pavements. Overweight permit fee administration, that's certainly something you would have to consider. Could we do it? Yes, we've got the data to do it. Estimated mileages can be reported. ESALs can easily be calculated. We already collect all sorts of data whenever somebody wants to get a permit for overloaded vehicles to cross bridges. That's done in the bridge office already. There are numerous policy issues regarding any kind of overweight permit fee structure. Numerous policy issues. Should fees be based on pavement impacts, bridge impacts, both, or none? Stop and think for just a moment. The bridge impacts alone are about $23 million if you look at the total VDOT maintenance budget. But there's only 30,000 vehicles. That means each one of those would be charged a fee of $770. That might be a large amount of money to charge just for bridges. Reasonable fees during difficult economic times. Certainly, we would need to examine the extent to which any kind of fee structure would impact the economy at this time and the trucking companies. There's a lot of exemptions in place. There's a lot of exemptions in place. And many of them can easily be argued to be very good, but there's 10,000 exemptions out there of all sorts. The code is full of exemptions. Many of those do create significant amounts of damage. Containerized freight is one example, 2 to 3 axle solid waste trucks are another. What about the revenue potential? Well, it's pretty simple. If all the vehicles that are presently charged for permits paid the fee that's equal to the tank wagons, it's $22 million a year. If you do something with containerized cargo and with solid waste, that's another 2.25. If you looked at permit fees for long-haul blanket permits, you could generate $30 to $50 million if you wish to do that. I'm not recommending, Mr. Secretary, that these be the fee structures. I've provided information for people to think about, and that concludes my presentation. Thank you.
Okay, thank you, Dr. Allen. And again, to clarify, the legislation does require the commissioner to make legislative recommendations. That one does not go through the CTB, so there's not a legislatively mandated role, but obviously there's there'll be informal consultation between now and when the commissioner sends his recommendations. I can't emphasize enough, this study only looks at overweight trucks. This does not capture the cost impacts of the average truck that is below the 80, in most cases 80,000 pounds, varies a little bit from category to category. But that's a very, very important distinction. We only looked in this study at overweight trucks that are permitted or potentially permitted. Questions, Mr. Billy?
Yes, sir.
Chairman, Dr. Allen did a couple of questions. Did you have an opportunity to compare Virginia's current fees and potential fees with those of other states?
I think we have done that. I don't have that at my fingertips, but we'd be happy to provide that to you.
And secondly, are there FHWA restrictions on the fees?
I don't think there are any restrictions on the fees. There are restrictions where trucks can go, especially with respect to bridges. There are restrictions on that, but not restrictions on the fees, to my knowledge.
In any way regulate the fees on interstates?
I do not believe so. Amy, Brian, can the fees be regulated on the interstate, or are we pretty clear to do whatever fees are necessary? So that means, in fact, that we don't have restrictions on the fees. We don't have restrictions on the
Chairman.
Fees.
Ms. Dean. Dr. Allen.
Yes, sir.
As far as the permit fee currently paying, that's for an overweight. What do we have any indication of what the fee, regular fee, is up for the 80,000 legal pounds at a factory?
There would be no fee other than the standard registration and license fees and the portion of the diesel tax that's received by the Commonwealth of Virginia.
So one thing that might be important if we begin to propose increase in fees is to know what this vehicle is paying on all these other incremental costs that go.
I think the point that the Secretary made with respect to that question is very important. This applies only to overweight. If you were going to charge weight-related fees below the overweight, then certainly you would need to take into account other fees that the trucks are paying. But with respect to overweight fees, I don't think it's necessary for us to do that.
Mr. Secretary, I think I heard you say, though, that you have the data for the difference in e-sales for cars and trucks.
Yes, sir, we do.
And so the principle of what you're talking about for overweight trucks can easily be applied to any vehicle, car or truck, based on the weight of it.
And its common cost.
And its common cost.
Yes, sir.
So it would not be hard to put out theoretical data about what it costs for a car to run over the highway for a certain distance and time, or a truck that weighed 80,000 pounds, or one that was even heavier.
That's correct.
So it's feasible to consider, if all the parties want to do it, a weight-related charge for using the highway.
Mm-hmm. It's feasible to consider.
With the theoretical data that you have.
Yes, absolutely.
That's all the point.
Governor Kane's original transportation package in 2006 actually did have weight-related registration fees. There was a graduated registration fee based on weight, highly controversial.
Yes.
Was not even taken up in committee. Okay, any other questions, Ms. Coulmay?
Would in your methodology, I don't know how to ask this, but to decide to move goods or a cargo by overweight vehicle is obviously a business decision.
Yes.
In other words, you decide that's to your benefit. It probably has economic benefit, you know, and so forth. So some additional charge there would simply be a part of a business decision that would be made by.
Yes, it would be all about the business decision and where you're going to allocate your resources. Absolutely.
And businesses do have a lot of different ways of adjusting their business models. You know, some open satellite locations, some service things from different places with different rules or in effect. So I'm not necessarily seeing this as some adjustment here as some necessary threat to any one business or any business in any sector or anything.
My economic training tells me I would agree with you 100%.
Thank you.
I would note on that point, the Port of Virginia, which is a vital economic component of Hampton Roads, going through some very difficult times, probably would be disproportionately affected by this, just looking at containerization. Obviously, there would be other discrete industries, but the port is one. You have to be extremely cautious about unintended consequences in this arena. Okay, any other questions of Dr. Allen? Thank you so much. You've made exciting and illuminating the arcane issue of truck weights and a very interesting topic.
Thank you.
All right. What I would like to do right now, we're going to suspend the work session. We'll take this up right at 9 a.m. tomorrow. The last item, the journey to Calo Grande, will receive a presentation from Ms. McGinnis on that. And then we'll go right into the business meeting. I suspect it'll be a very quick action agenda. Now, tonight at 6:30, all of you, is anyone not aware of the invitation to the Women in Transportation reception at Main Street Station? There are directions at your place. Some of our colleagues are going to be appropriately recognized tonight, so I think it's very, very helpful. If you need directions or help getting there, does anyone not know how to get to Main Street Station from here? There's a map at your place. Carol can certainly help with the arrangements if you need any assistance in that way. For those who would like to go to dinner, there are reservations, I believe, at 8 o'clock. We can, you know, that's obviously not mandatory. Some may want to go back to their room at that, and that will be within walking distance of Main Street Station. If not, we'll see you all here tomorrow morning at 9 a.m. Thank you.
Good morning, everyone. Yesterday afternoon, we recessed the Tunnel Transportation Board work session. So for those who are here, I know Ms. McMenemy is here and perhaps others want to address the board. We will be seeking public comment at the conclusion of the work session. We have one final item on the Hallowed Ground presentation. And we have the executive director of that organization, Kate Wyatt McGinnis, here this morning to walk us through a presentation on this wonderful, actually multi-state initiative. So, welcome. Do you need a little help with the remote control there? We have our remote control expert right here.
Thank you very much. It's a pleasure to be with you this morning. Again, my name is Kate McGinnis Wyatt. I'm the president of the Journey Through Hallowed Ground Partnership. I'm here to brief you on this initiative and to request your support on two specific resolutions before you. The information load may seem heavy, but we thought it very important that you have a proper briefing for those who have not had the benefit of understanding the organization behind this initiative, the goals, and our very systematic way of achieving them. What we're talking about here is a 175-mile-long corridor generally following the old Carolina Road from Gettysburg through Maryland and into Virginia following Route 15 to Orange and then over onto Route 231 down into Charlottesville. What we found is within this swath of land is more American history and heritage than any other swath of land in the country, including the home of 9 United States presidents. And more than the bricks and mortar, what we found is that every generation that lived within this region placed life and livelihood on the line to create this country and to create this notion called democracy. It's most recently been pointed out by President-elect Obama's first sentence in his acceptance speech, where he quoted Jefferson's Declaration of Independence and where his inaugural is based on the words from the Gettysburg Address, the two bookends, of course, of our initiative. We also found 11,000 years of Native American history, 400 years of European and African American history, 2 World Heritage Sites, 49 historic districts, and over 1 million acres already on the National Register of Historic Places. This includes the largest concentration of Civil War battlefield sites in the country, Now, if we want to talk about a generation that placed life and livelihood on the line, we can stop right there. And it wasn't just the 630,000 men and soldiers who fell, but it was also the slaves who ran in the name of freedom, the Quakers who harbored them, and virtually every single town and community within this swath of land. Some of it burned to the ground like Haymarket, some of them ransomed, many of them split right down the middle, and each of them responsible for rebuilding this country. We also see that this region was critically important during the French and Indian War, another generation that placed life and livelihood on the line, the Revolutionary War and the War of 1812. In our early research, we found that there are 20 historic Main Street communities right along this corridor. These are the places that are the heartbeat, if you will, of our communities, where more than business was done, where communities were created. Each of these has been challenged because they can't compete with regional malls. They desperately depend on the tourists to visit, and they have been working to recreate themselves. We also have 13 national park units within this swath of land. What we found is that this corridor is like the spine on the chapters of our American history. What we found quite curious is that as this corridor links these historic sites, the fact of the matter is the historic sites are there because the road was there first. From the very beginning, we wanted to recognize the importance of this roadbed itself, and that is why I'm here before you today. We also realized the great opportunity this road corridor provided our communities, our businesses, and our citizens, because we found that tourism is the number one industry throughout this entire region. And curiously, heritage tourism is the fastest growing element of the tourist industry. Yet, for reasons unknown at the time, 3.5 years ago, visitation to every single one of these heritage sites was trending downwards, including the parks. That has a significant impact on our businesses throughout this corridor. And what we realized is that if we could brand this region, if we could raise to national recognition the importance of this area, we could at once both give homage to our heritage and at the same time support our communities. So with that, 3 years ago, we built a business plan and set out these 5 goals to be achieved by the end of this year. The first is a national awareness campaign that this is where America happened. The second is educational outreach programs for students of every age to engage the younger generation as well as continuous learning generation. The third and fourth, our 2 federal programs. We surveyed all the federal programs because we realized we weren't the first in the country to try to do something along this vein and found just 2 that were almost tailor-made for our initiatives. The first, it was an act of Congress to have the entire region designated as a national heritage area. That's a 20-year-old program. At the time we began this initiative, there were 27 already in the country. The second federal program that seemed to make the most sense was the Federal Highway Administration's program that's been around for 15 years to designate just the road itself as an all-American national scenic byway. The fifth goal has never been done in the country, and that is to create a socially responsible land purchase trust in recognition that the land on either side of this corridor is privately owned. We have nor seek any regulatory authority. We recognize that we should be positioned to purchase land at fair market value, which is critically important to telling our history. So in the past 3 years on the national awareness campaign, the first thing we did was go to every town council and board of supervisors, board of commissioners, and put out our business plan. I'm thrilled to report to you that every single elected body voted in public hearing to participate actively in creating the journey through hallowed ground. We also have the support of the governors of all 4 states, members of Congress from each of the jurisdictions, as well as national support. We created stakeholder groups. The leadership council is made up of the mayors of each of the communities and the chairman of the Board of Supervisors. They have been meeting almost on an every other month basis, intimately involved in the creation of this business plan. We created a standing committee of the directors of each of those historic Main Street communities, most of whom have budgets of about $6,000 a year. And their goal is to attract the world. By working collaboratively, we might get there, but certainly individually, it's a pretty high hurdle. We created a standing committee of the directors of tourism from each of the 15 counties who have worked collaboratively now over the past several years to create cooperative marketing programs as well as research programs. We created a standing committee of the superintendents of each of those 13 national park units. Now, what's interesting is that the national parks cannot, by law, market themselves. But we can market them and help them with interpretation outside the boundaries of the park. The big push here is the 150th anniversary, the sesquicentennial of the Civil War, which is upon us in 2011. We've been asked to take the lead on creating a regional and national initiative for that commemoration. What was woefully lacking in our early research was the contributions of female Americans, African Americans, and Native Americans. So we sought, obtained, and have completed research through obtaining grants on the African American contributions within this swath of land. This research has proven so good that it's now being published in books as well as travel guides. We also published a travel guidebook to make it easy for visitors to come, to visit, to stay, not just to the historic sites, but to the vineyards and stay in the B&Bs. I'm thrilled to report that National Geographic Society has just published a book based on our research called The Journey Through Hallowed Ground, The Birthplace of the American Ideal. I want to show you this. The cover photographer from National Geographic took the photographs for the book. The foreword is written by the woman who just won the Pulitzer Prize, Geraldine Brooks, for her book on the Civil War called March. C-SPAN covered the unveiling of this book and our annual meeting, and the nice thing is they have replayed the 90 minutes of that meeting 8 different times. And each time there's been a direct hit to our website, increased requests for maps, and direct visitation to the sites. So on the awareness campaign, this has been a wonderful advantage. 2-time-winning Pulitzer Prize-winning writer David McCullough spoke at our annual meeting, and he said, "God bless you for what you're doing with this marvelous achievement. This is a big idea. This is an example for the country, and it can change the way we are teaching our children to write a situation that needs correcting as soon as possible. The Journey Through Hallowed Ground is one of the greatest schools, one of the greatest seminars, one of the greatest graduate schools of American history anywhere in the country." National Geographic thought so highly of this book, they put on a special reception and presentation of the book at their headquarters, introduced by their chairman. And it was filmed and is now being used as a pilot to travel this exhibit of the different photographs and artifacts from the region around the country. We conducted a national poll to see what others throughout the country thought of this region. We think pretty highly of it ourselves, but that really doesn't matter, does it? But it was astonishing to see that throughout the country, the way people describe this region, historic, educational, scenic, humbling, sobering. This was wonderful affirmation of our efforts to share these stories and make it easy for the visitors to come. And when asked, over 80% said that this would be an excellent trip for families with children between 13 and 17 years old. We also found within the heritage tourism segment of the population, over 10% of the population heard of the Journey Through Hallowed Ground. As I mentioned, the big push and the opportunities within the business plan, what makes it sustainable is that every year, there is another reason to celebrate or commemorate. We all saw the great efforts that went into Jamestown, Yorktown celebration. Imagine that we could do something almost every year along the journey that keeps bringing people back. And our big push, as I mentioned, is the sesquicentennial of the Civil War, which actually kicks off next year in Harper's Ferry with the commemoration of the raid, John Brown's raid. And in anticipation of that, we sought and have succeeded in obtaining a $236,000 grant to train the people who can most affect the visitor experience, the frontline hospitality. It's interesting, we'll have spent millions of dollars in branding the region, attracting people from Australia, from New Zealand, who are, by the way, particularly interested in the Civil War. But what we don't want to have happen is for these people to show up and then, when asked a question about history or what else is new in the region, to have a shrugged shoulder or a rude exchange. So we are going to launch a program to train these people, providing them history lessons and keeping them current on what's going on in the region, so that the visitor will stay longer, spend more money, leave with bragging rights, and can't wait to come back. We also are looking at a legacy program of a landscaping plan along the entire journey for the sesquicentennial. I'll move quickly through the next elements. The educational outreach programs are driven by a standing committee of outstanding educators, including those from the National Park Service, our teachers, heritage site educators. We've created a two-week summer camp called the Extreme Journey Through Hallowed Ground for rising middle school students. It has been rolled out with the public school systems in Albemarle, Loudoun County, as well as Adams County, Pennsylvania. The students arrive, they receive a briefing packet that's stamped confidential with a code they have to decipher. Once they open it up, it is a mission briefing book stamped top secret, and they're immediately told that they are agents in the Journey Through Hallowed Ground Intelligence Agency, and their mission over the 2 weeks is to uncover the mysteries of history through espionage. They have to assume the identities of people who actually went before them. Within an hour, we have the kids canoeing 10 miles down the Potomac River as one of the members of the Battle of Falls Bluff, scaling the bluff itself, asked would they make the same decisions. We arm them with iPods, digital cameras, and video cameras because over the 2 weeks, they make their own documentary on what leadership means to them. They are one of the members of the Constitutional Convention at Montpelier. This is Benjamin Franklin, you see on the right. They are an African-American student for a day in a one-room schoolhouse. They bike 15 miles through Gettysburg, hike the C&O Canal, and in the end are transformed into understanding that history doesn't just happen and it's not black and white. Decisions are made every day and contributions of each citizen makes a difference. We have similar courses to teach our teachers, both UVA and Virginia Tech Graduate Schools of Urban Design have taken on a full semester course on the journey. These are the Virginia Tech students who designed a bicycle and pedestrian route for the entire 175 miles. The goal of obtaining an act of Congress, I'm thrilled to report, is achieved. On May 8th, the President signed into law the Journey Through Hallowed Ground National Heritage Area. This authorizes up to $1 million a year, which we have to match dollar for dollar. But in fact and in reality, we'll be lucky if we see $150,000, given the budgetary constraints. The fourth goal, designation by the Federal Highway Administration as an all-American road. This requires two components. The first is that every inch of the road first be designated as a state scenic byway. I'm thrilled to report that our partners in Pennsylvania have achieved that. Our partners in Maryland have achieved that. In fact, we already have the road segment in Maryland designated as a national scenic byway. This program has two levels. National scenic byways, and there are, I think, 100 of those now in the country. And then the very top echelon is the All-American Road designation, and there are 24 of those. We're going for the very top. When we started this, the Virginia State Scenic Byway Maps, and anecdotally, I should tell you, one of the first people I sat down with was then Secretary of Transportation, Whit Clement, and we pulled out the State Scenic Byway Maps, and it showed most of this corridor on a State Scenic Byway. There were small pockets that needed to have local jurisdiction request your attention. Well, lo and behold, if we didn't find that those state scenic byway maps were, oops, wrong. And as a result, most of this entire corridor has gone to public hearing in each of these jurisdictions, and they have in turn, through research, decided to request your assistance in designating this corridor as a state scenic byway. One of those portions that was originally on the map and was incorrect is a section in the very end, and that would be Route 729, 53, and right down there. At the very bottom, you see the yellow portion. All the rest has already been designated a state scenic byway, so the resolution before you today, at the request of Albemarle and the City of Charlottesville, is to designate that one little portion a state scenic byway to ensure it's part of this application. The second part is to complete a corridor management plan. This is an initiative we began over 20 months ago. We've had over 60 community meetings. We have held these meetings throughout the corridor, including all of the stakeholders. We have gone to each community and asked them one simple question: what do you want this road to look like in 30 years' time? And how can we help get you there? We took that input, built a plan, went back to every single community. I would like to point out that we've had the wonderful assistance of Winky Chenault and other members, Pam Liston of the VDOT team, I think they're here, Lynn Crump, and others from the Department of Conservation and Recreation, as well as Department of Historic Resources. We've had your counsel, and I want to thank you for that from time to time. We took the plan, wrote it, drafted it, sent it out, went back to every community and said, did we hear you correctly? They have been actively engaged. We received 552 remarks on how to better the plan. Those were all incorporated, including those from VDOT personnel. Reissued the plan. Held then public meetings that were advertised to make sure that we were, again, accurately reflecting the wishes of the communities, and are now back before each community asking them to adopt this plan and a resolution of support, and as of this moment, every community has. The requirements for each state's application differ. We had to submit our application to Maryland this past Monday. We will submit this application to VDOT by December 3rd, and PennDOT actually accelerated their schedule from the time this was written, and we have already submitted our application to Pennsylvania. So in short, we ask for your support of the resolution in support of the All-American Road designation and the Corridor Management Plan as it's to be submitted. The overarching themes for this entire initiative are that this is the land of leadership. It's a land of conflict and reunification, and it's a land of outstanding beauty. I leave you with that briefing, and we'll be happy to address any questions you have.
Thank you, Ms. Wyatt. And this is action items 5 and 6 in the business meeting today. Are there any questions, Ms. Wyatt? Comments?
Congratulations.
We sure appreciate the detailed presentation. You mentioned a corridor landscape plan is something I would be interested in. You know, one of the discussions we've had as we have to cut some of our roadside maintenance, there's actually an opportunity to do things with native plantings and things like that that actually save money and may mesh up well with some of the goals here. And so I think there's some opportunities for overlap in that regard.
Mr. Chair. Thank you for mentioning that. I wonder if that also might be a possibility for some enhancement grants.
I suspect that Ms. Wyatt is aggressive in her search for enhancement grants and will probably take that as a leading indicator.
Allow me just to take one moment with this notion, because each of the communities have considered this. Like the celebration at Jamestown, each community is now being asked to consider a legacy project, and most have, you know, considered flagpoles or another monument. But when we suggest to them that 630,000 soldiers fell, that the greatest concentration of the battlefields and certainly the troop activity was within this corridor, a simple landscaping plan I can't say 630,000 trees, but almost as a living memorial. Same tree planted, marching up this corridor, is a powerful notion. Each community has embraced it. In practice, it's going to be very difficult. You know, in theory, it sounds elegant and wonderful. It's one of those notions that in 50 years' time, when the trees are really mature, people come just to see the trees and think, what visionaries they were to do something like this. We're fully aware that in practice it's more difficult, but we have already begun discussions with private sector foundations and individual donors to help us look at building a landscaping plan for this entire region. And if it looks viable, you certainly know we'll be back in front of you. Thank you.
Thank you. Any other questions or comments? Thank you, Ms. Wyatt. And we'll be taking this up on the action agenda. We do have a couple of intervening items, so we hope you'll be able to stay for that.
Thank you. I will.
Before we conclude the work session, I'd like to add an additional item. Last night, we were so privileged to see Ms. Carter and Ms. Connolly honored at the Women in Transportation Symposium. There was another presentation last night, caught me a little bit off guard, which was acknowledging the incredible work of Donna Purcell Mays since the late 1970s in public affairs in VDOT. And Donna, I wonder if you might come up very briefly. We're going to have under new business a resolution recognizing Donna. Most of you have worked with Donna at some point or other. And I just wanted to take an opportunity to acknowledge, you know, the growth of professionalism and outreach, and most importantly, honesty. One of the things that has, I think, been a hallmark of VDOT and your tenure there is to find out what people need to know, to get that information. Sometimes that has difficult consequences. Honesty has its burden. And the brief resolution that the board will take up recognizes the professionalism and your contribution to public affairs. And just I want to say on a personal note how much fun it has been to work with you, whether it's a hurricane, whether it's somebody who doesn't like the planting of that particular kind of tree in that particular median. In our world, there are a lot of bruised egos at the state and the local and sometimes the federal legislature, and sometimes that task has fallen to Ms. Mays. Working with the congressional delegation and governors stretching back to 1977, there's just a sweep of history and growth and a professionalism that we want to be sure and recognize. I won't burden you further with that, but I just want to say on behalf of the entire CTB and VDOT and DRPT and the ports and the airports who have all relied on you, how much we appreciate your great work on behalf of the Commonwealth. You're welcome to say something if you want to take a second, and then I'm going to turn the floor over to the members of the board if anybody would like to add to that. So, Donna?
Thank you very much. That was very much a surprise, as you could see. I did prepare a few remarks, but I'll just share with you two things. I've sort of developed a reputation as being the go-to person for unusual questions at VDOT. I'd like to share with you two of the most memorable questions I can remember receiving. The first one was from a Washington Post reporter earlier this year who wanted to know if VDOT is composting deer. Interested in the answer? The answer is we've heard of it and we're looking into it.
Ms. Mays is under consideration for Secretary of State.
But the other one I have to share with you came years ago. The first time I addressed the board, in fact, the last time I addressed the board was 21 years ago to present the Adopt a Highway program to you all to understand it. Well, a few years later, I received a call from a person in a residency, and he said, Donna, I have a group that's very interested in adopting a highway. but I have to develop special safety conditions for them to participate, and could you help me with that? And I said, sure, but why do they need special consideration? He said, because they're nudists. So I am pleased to announce that we developed safety criteria. And this gentleman presented them to the group in his Sunday suit while they were wearing their birthday suit. You can tell why.
Thank you. Donna, thank you.
Tough expo. Thank you for coming. I know this would not have been your first choice, but we can't let you get away without acknowledging your wonderful work. Thank you for coming.